Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
Listen to them. Children of the night. What music they make.
What an excellent day for an exorcism.
You wouldn't be able to do these awful things to me if I weren't still in this chair.
But you are, Blanche. You are in that chair.
Who's in the box?
Put the gun down, baby.
No, what's in the box?
Wolves have a territorial range of about 300 miles and a kill range of 30. If we're close to their den, and if we're within that radius, then they'll come after us.
How can we tell if we're close?
We can't.
What in God's name are you talking about?
The son, Mr. Thorne. The son of the devil.
You're insane.
He must die, Mr. Thorne!
You do not want to go that way.
What's that way?
Officer, sir, you do not want to go that way. We're going to the mall.
Hello, Dexter Morgan.
Hello, welcome once again to Dark Discussions, your place for the discussion of horror film, fiction, and all that's fantastic. I am one of your co-hosts, Philip, from the state of New Hampshire in the U.S. of A., and with me in the state of Michigan.
This is Eric.
Eric, how are you, sir?
I'm fine.
Excellent. And in the state of New York?
This is Mike.
Mike, how are you, sir?
I'm fine, Phil. How are you?
I'm doing all right. And a Connecticut American?
This is Chrissy.
Chrissy, how are you?
I'm doing awesome.
Very good. Co-host Abe from Massachusetts will not be joining us due to a essay that he's writing for college, the class that he's taking. So he will not be able to attend tonight, but expect him back next week.
I miss a lot about school, not the work.
That's a good point, Mike. I would agree with that. I think 22 to 35, those were the best years, because it was you're getting paid and you don't have schoolwork. But either way. A couple of things, house cleaning stuff. First off, Eric, you do 4 total podcasts?
Jesus, yes. Here we go again. I do this one, Dark Freak! Discussions, which has 2 spinoff podcasts, one of which is You Know Nothing, Jon Snow, a Game of Thrones podcast, in which we discuss episodes of Game of Thrones while it's on the air, which is not right now, but we'll be back in 2017. We do another podcast called Both Brothels and Bots about the HBO show Westworld, which we do while that show is on the air, which is not anymore. We have 1 wrap-up episode to do, and then we won't be back with that until 2018. I do a podcast of my own, which is a general interest podcast called The Askancity Podcast, spelled A-S-K-A-N-C-I-T-Y. You can find that on Stitcher in the iTunes store.
Excellent. Very good. And Mike, besides doing 3 podcasts, you also do a genre book?
Yes, I only do 3. I'm not as big a loser. I also do Unnatural Selections, www.unnaturalselections.com.
Excellent. Very good. And Chrissy, you do things?
I do things. I do lots of things. I can seed your minds with all sorts of dirty images.
Just the legal stuff.
Just the legal stuff. I write short dark fiction. And I also do a monthly YouTube series called This Writing Life. A new episode is about to be posted this weekend. And you can find out more about me at www.christypetersonschoonover.com.
Oh, very good. A couple of things. Here it's www.darkdiscussions.com. On the bottom of every page, there are links to our Facebook group, our Twitter account, our email, Stitcher, iTunes, and so forth. You can listen to all 250-plus episodes right off the website, or you can subscribe to either iTunes or go to Stitcher to listen. That also includes both You Know Nothing, Jon Snow, a Game of Thrones podcast, as well as Bullets, Brothels, and Bots, a Westworld podcast. One other thing is that we do have a Patreon account. Patreon is a place where folks who listen to the podcast can donate money to the podcast if they so desire. The reason we do this is because a couple of our listeners asked if they could donate some money to the podcast to help out to pay for the web address and all those things, especially since we do this for free. So if you would like to do that, it would be www.patreon.com/darkdiscussions. And for every $5 that you donate, you will be able to put a movie into a figurative hat, where at the end of each quarter, we pick a movie from you, the donators, to do an episode on. Since we don't have that many donators, your chance of having your film chosen is actually pretty good at this time. The last quarter, we did The Howling. Howling was picked by Michelle Barkley, one of our listeners. However, for Q1 of 2017, that will be when we pick next. And so, for example, if you donate $15, you could choose three films: Bioslime, Dune, and Brian De Palma's Passion. And if you prefer, you could actually just choose Brian De Palma's Passion three times as your choices. So you can mix it up and match it any way you like. And again, at the end of December, basically the first podcast we do in January, we will pick out of the figurative hat a new winner and a new episode that you, the donating listeners, have chosen. Mike, iTunes.
Well, again, to be clear, it doesn't have to be those three. Any three or the same, any, but those are just examples, just to be clear.
Yes, I actually, every time I use examples, I just look on my bookcase and choose the first three films I see, and it happened to be those three films this week. Now, Mike, iTunes reviews.
Did we get any?
I don't know, but you usually let folks know about doing
that. Yeah, I haven't actually checked in iTunes for a while because I'm not an Apple cultist. But if you are one of those people, or if you use Stitcher or some other service to listen to our podcast instead of streaming it directly from the website, which is, of course, www.darkdiscussions.com, if you could leave us some feedback, leave us some reviews, 5 stars, 1 star, 3.5 stars, 2 stars. Nobody really cares about a 2-star review. But anyway, whatever you give us. The more reviews we get, the higher our profile is, the easier it's going to be for people to find us. So if they go onto iTunes and search for horror podcasts, then they'll be more likely to see us near the top. Remember, we are a twice award nominated, actually 3-time award nominated horror podcast. So we are up there. We're good. Damn it. Doesn't matter that we didn't win. Being nominated was an honor. But if you could just give us a review and tell everybody how wonderful we are and how much we have changed your lives and touched you in a deep, emotional, sensitive location, then, you know, more people will find us. The podcast will do better. It'll give us more opportunities maybe to go to conventions and raise our profile. And again, once again, always the end goal, take over the world.
Yep. And what we do here is we talk intelligently about a genre that deserves intelligence. And that basically is cult films such as horror, sci-fi, fantasy, thrillers, techno thrillers, mysteries, grindhouse films, midnight films, drive-in films, and whatnot. So we look at all films as potential art, and we try to not only critique but also give our opinions of what the filmmakers were trying to tell us. Now, any news anybody wanted to bring up? Quick news, like big news, basically, or passings. Eric, no. What about you, Chrissy or Mike?
Well, we did lose, not exactly horror related, but we did lose former senator and astronaut John Glenn today.
We did. He was an astronaut, a war hero, a fighter pilot for the Army Air Corps, both in Korea and in World War II. He actually flew with Ted Williams, Boston Red Sox legend. And he also.
But we won't hold that against him.
Fair enough. And he also was a senator for 24 years for four terms as well. And
Democratic senator from Ohio, to be clear.
That's right. And what he did was basically do real nonfiction science, and as being an astronaut and doing what he did, was quite impressive. So hopefully with the new president, we'll get back with NASA being a major force in space and aeronautics, because in the past 8 years, unfortunately, it's been kind of, I don't know, you know, we don't fly ships, spaceships anymore. We actually hook on to Europe or China or someone else who's shooting up the rockets. So hopefully we'll get back to space like we saw in the great film The Martian.
Right. Now, just to be clear, John Glenn was the first American to do a complete orbit of the Earth.
That's correct.
He was also, I think, the first to do, was it a supersonic transatlantic flight, I think. But he was a test pilot. He was, again, one of the first astronauts from the Mercury missions, and a war hero and a senator. And it's funny when, you know, senator is the least of your accomplishments on that list.
He was also a presidential candidate as well.
Yeah, and the it's true. Yes, you're right. And and somehow he wasn't picked. So he's 95 years old. So it's not exactly like he lived a tragic life or anything. But I did want to single him out and give him credit for what he's done.
Yes, and he deserves it, even if it is fact rather than fiction, because again, as I discussed, he was part of a major science of the 20th century. Any other news? Anyone? If not, I guess we can get into our Tarot Tantrum for tonight. Tarot Tantrums, what they are. It's basically an author from the New England area named Patrick Lacey, who has numerous novellas and short stories, who reviews a new release on Blu-ray, basically, of some obscure horror film or genre film that is usually released by such studios or release companies as Arrow or Scream Factory or Criterion or whatnot. And he basically says how, not only how the movie was, but also if the remastering and all the extras on the disc are worth your, I guess, money to go check it out. So let's hear what he has to say.
And welcome to another edition of Terror Tantrums. My name is Patrick Lacey, horror author and longtime listener to Dark Discussions. If you're new to the podcast, this is a segment where I take a look at a slightly lesser known or obscure horror film and give it a hopefully unbiased review, as usually I am seeing it for the first time. That is the case this week. This is a very, very good one. It's A Blood and Black Lace, directed by Mario Bava and released recently in a handy-dandy special edition from Arrow. I should say there are two editions from Arrow. One is a steelbook and costs slightly more, and one is just a regular, they come in like clear Blu-ray cases, and it also includes the DVD. I went with the regular one because for some odd reason I do not like the look of steelbooks, and I can't account for why that is, but and they also charge like $20 more, I think, $15 to $20 more on the steel case, which to me is just not okay. Yeah, let me quickly read you the synopsis. I'm going to read you two different ones this week. Part of the fun of Terror Tantrums has been looking at these different back cover copies and synopses that I can gather. And a lot of them are spot on. A lot of them are way off the mark. A lot of them are very detailed. A lot of them are very succinct. You'll find that these two different ones are about as succinct as they get. So this first one is pulled from the back cover copy itself. It says, six models, six victims for a crazed masked killer. The Christian haute couture fashion house is a home to models and backstabbing and blackmail and drug deals and murder. So that's one way to look at it. This is an even better one. This one I pulled from IMDb, and I think it might be the shortest back cover copy I've ever read on the show or that's ever been read anywhere ever. It just says, a shadowy killer in black brutally murders fashion models. And that there's nothing wrong with that back cover copy, because it is both accurate and, yeah, it gets to the point of what the movie's about. Basically, you have this fashion academy with these models who are in training, and there is this killer who sort of – so he wears a black trench coat, if you can imagine that, a black sort of – I don't even know what they're called, but it's something you'd see like a gangster wear in the 1920s, those kind of hats. I'm sorry, I'm not up on my hat terminology. I'll have to study haberdashery type stuff some more. And then – He has sort of this white mask on that almost looks like a ski mask, but it's very white. Can't see his eyes, can't see any features. He kind of looks like an early 1964, which is when this film was released, rendition of Slender Man. That's all I could think of. So it's interesting. I wonder if that whole phenomenon came from this movie or was at least influenced by it. I don't know, but it's sort of something interesting to note, parallel going on there. So basically, yeah, we have the shadowed killer. He's going around killing different people, but the plot sort of thickens because each of these people he's killing, like the first synopsis said, which was at least 1 to 2 sentences longer, there's a lot of backstabbing going on between the people running it and the models themselves. There's some blackmail. After each subsequent killing, the number of people that could be the killer sort of increases exponentially. So in terms of just being a mystery, which this movie isn't just a mystery, but if you look at the mystery at its core, it's very, very interesting, and it definitely has a lot of depth. It's not just a straight-up whodunit, because usually in those movies you've got sort of like 2 or 3 people who it could be, and they're sort of pointing you in the direction of one person that's just classic misdirection. It's clearly not that person. This person, they sort of set up a case for each of the possible killers, and it literally could be any of them. And when the final reveal comes, I won't spoil it. But it's definitely not in a way it was kind of what I was expecting, but then they flip it and they add a whole new like layer to it that sort of threw me off guard. So the mystery at the core of this film is very, 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 very well done. Possibly one of the best mysteries I have ever seen, but it is not just a mystery. It is a giallo. And if you've listened to past episodes of Terror Tantrums, I almost said Dark Discussions, but that also applies. You will know that I am a huge fan of giallo. So this isn't, I don't think, a straight-up giallo, because it's still early on when they're classifying that term. They had giallo books, which is kind of where the term originally came from. Giallo in Italian obviously means yellow, so they were all these yellow books that were sort of mystery and horror books, a lot of them translated from English. And they usually typically had yellow covers, so that's kind of one of the standing definitions of where that term came from. It's kind of refuted, but we're going to use that as a working definition, and I'll tell you why we're using that one in just a bit. But so Mario Bava, you probably recognize his name. He's better known for movies like Black Sabbath, Black Sunday, and A Bay of Blood, but this is certainly in some of his well-known ones as well. That sounded redundant. But anyway, so this sort of, if it's not a full-on giallo movie, it's because it's setting up the conventions of future giallo movies. So if you see this, you can't dispute the fact that directors like Lucio Fulci, not as much him, but in his earlier stuff, he was definitely more giallo. Dario Argento, and definitely a huge portion of his catalog. Sergio Martino, and obviously Lamberto Bava, which is Mario Bava's son. All these Italian film directors, when they went on to do giallos, they were using this movie and a couple other Mario Bava movies as blueprints. So it's kind of interesting to watch this movie because it's 1964, so a lot of the giallo conventions aren't set up, because this is setting them up. So you see sort of kills, they're not from the point of view of the killer, but they're set up in very giallo fashion. The lighting is very lush and very colorful. So you can definitely see in that regard where Dario Argento got a lot of his techniques in terms of lighting and setting up a scene. So yeah, it's sort of interesting. It's half what giallo would become, and sort of half older Italian cinema of conventions that are still in place, kind of going out of style. And it just gives it a very, very surreal quality. And I'll say, if you don't like the first kill scene in this movie, which is, I guess, the first 5 minutes of it, you won't like the rest of it, because it's very, in tune with what that scene is. But I think, for my money, and this is kind of a bold statement, it's one of the best kill scenes in any Italian horror movie, is that opening scene. And if you watch the film, you know exactly what I mean. But the camera work, the lighting, the score, just the suspense of it all is absolutely astounding. Talking about it right now, I honestly want to watch it again. But yeah, this is a great film. If you like giallo, if you like Italian cinema in general, a great score, great lighting, like I said. And the kill scenes, particularly, it's interesting. There's not a ton of blood and gore, because like I said, this is 1964 in Italy. So the ratings board there, I think, was still kind of strict. But the kill scenes themselves, the killer is very violent. He'll grab one of the models and just throw her against a door or onto the floor. In this, I don't know if it's the sound design of the film or something, but when he's sort of like punching or like lashing out, it's very, very violent, and it sort of like is disturbing in its own right before the blood even comes to play. And like I said, the blood isn't that plentiful, but I don't know, this, watch this film and you'll see what I mean. But there's something about the way he his violence and the way he actually like just lashes out at people that is, it's very disturbing. I can't quite put a finger on it, but I thought I'd throw that out there in case anyone else watches this. So let me know if you have the same reaction, because it definitely got under my skin. But no, that is the film as a whole. It's a very, very, very good film, made even better by Arrow's release. I really like what Arrow does. Some of their films, their releases don't have that great of special features, but usually in my experience, those movies themselves are so good that it kind of gets a pass for the special features. This not only has a great film, but it is loaded with special features. The main one that I watched and that I would recommend is, I can't even find the name of it here. I'm looking through the list of special features. There are so many. Where did it go? Okay, that's what it is. It's called Psychoanalysis, and it's basically an hour, I think it's an hour and 15 minute long documentary with all these Italian filmmakers. Dario Argento is above it, Lombardo Bava is in it, etc. And then there's also like psychologists, there's crime novelists, there's just people involved in the film industry in general. And it's literally what it sounds like. It's giving you a psychoanalysis of Giallo and helping us kind of better define that term. And that's where I said that the Giallo books come into play. They give you a nice setup of those novels with the yellow covers, etc., and then they bring it on into film. And it's interesting, they talk about how a lot of Giallos are essentially murder mysteries, but they're not just trying to figure out who did it, they're trying to figure out why this killer is doing it. A lot of time it's sort of a weird psychosexual thing going on, but it adds a layer to your Giallo watching from here on out. I think I'll watch Giallo movies differently, because that's definitely right on the nose. There's a lot of times they're trying to figure out what motivates this killer, and a lot of times it's a very odd sort of fetish or phobia or something, what have you. And it almost becomes, even though a lot of these Giallos aren't supernatural, it almost elevates them to a supernatural level, which is why a lot of them, even though they're essentially just murder mysteries and proto typical slashers, they almost become horror movies because of that added layer. So I can't tell you how interesting that documentary is, and I barely scratched the surface of the rest of the special features. So if any of that sounds interesting at all, even if you're only a little bit into Giallos and you want to learn a lot more about the history of them, sort of the subtext of them, buy this movie for that documentary alone. But not only is that documentary amazing, the film itself is absolutely astounding. So this week I'm giving an A+ on both fronts. You have to see this movie if you A, like Giallos, like Italian cinema in general, or just want to learn more about that genre. It is absolutely fantastic. So do yourself a favor. Go out right now and buy either the Steelbook or the regular edition of Blood and Black Lace, released through Arrow. That is it this week. As always, if you have a suggestion for a slightly lesser known or obscure horror film, hit the guys up on the Facebook group, or shoot them an email at darkdiscussions@aol.com. If I haven't seen the film, or possibly even if I have, I will add it to my ever-growing pile of films. Next week, we will not close out the year, because I guess there are two more episodes coming up, but we will definitely do a seasonal film. That's your hint for now. But as always, until then, thanks so much for listening, and I will see you guys on the flip side.
All right, so we are back, and once again, thanks to Patrick Lacey for that. And stay tuned to next week when he'll have another. Since we pretty much got all the formalities, I guess we can get into our topic for tonight. So,
You know what? There is one thing I do want to mention before we we switch. So close. Well, no, it's just because, in case people missed last week's episode, we did announce last week that the calendar for 2017 had to be postponed, and we'll be releasing the 2017 calendar in 2018. which may be.
Did you guys actually announce that?
Well,
I wasn't here, so I don't know.
Well, kind of.
Kind of, sort of. That it was just we didn't allow ourselves quite enough time to get all the artwork and everything done and arranged to get the calendar out in a timely manner. And we didn't think you'd want it to get a 2017 calendar in like March. So rather we'll wait a little bit. We'll have it out next year and you'll still see all that wonderful artwork, get all that wonderful information and be able to support the Dark Discussions podcast and further our goal to take over the world. You just have to wait a few months extra. We're sorry for the people who got really, really, really excited over this. And, you know, you've been waiting by the mailbox, even though you haven't been able to order it yet, but it's coming. It will be there.
Yes, yes.
No promises.
Yeah, yeah. It'll probably start selling it earlier, so like July or something. And I know Diana of New Jersey wanted to purchase 5. She actually emailed me a couple days ago asking about the calendar because she wanted to make sure she got 5 copies of it for her friends and family. But unfortunately, yeah, we're going to postpone it. So we, as Mike pretty much explained it all, so we can get a real top notch product out, and have more time to, put it together. So, all right, very good. And, I guess we can, pretty much discuss the new topic for tonight. So, Eric, why don't you let everybody know what we're going to discuss?
Tonight, we are going to be talking about a Dutch movie called The Windmill.
Welcome with Happy Holland Tours. Got a ticket.
Ladies and gentlemen, without windmills, there would be no Holland. More than half of Holland lies under sea level.
Unbelievable. Well, the buzz doesn't start. Let the motor calm down a little bit.
There are no windmills marked anywhere near here.
So?
Well, what's that then?
What's the legend?
Miller sells his soul to the devil for the secret of keeping his blades turning wind or no wind.
We need to leave here. It's not safe for
us. Listen, you mad bitch. Put it down.
That's right. The Windmill, also originally under its festival circuit title, was called The Windmill Massacre. This film, The Windmill, is the follow-up to actually a pretty damn good film. The director is named Nick Jorgurius, and one of the writers is named Chris...
Mitchell.
Mitchell, thank you. And they are the people behind the film Frankenstein's Army, which is actually, this should probably be on your agenda, Christy, because it is a found footage film. It was a pretty popular film about 2 years ago, basically found footage of a Soviet, force that entered Poland, I think it is, and they found a Nazi bunker. This was during World War II.
Ooh, what's the name of this again? I'm sorry, I want to write this down.
Frankenstein's Army.
Okay, go on.
And so basically the Soviet troops trying to liberate, or quote-unquote liberate, Eastern Europe from the Nazis. And when they do, they find an underground bunker, and they find some, as we've heard in the past, Nazi cult stuff. And so all hell breaks loose, and the Soviet strike force may be in trouble, so... It's worth to take a look. I actually have the Frankenstein's Army on Blu-ray, and it was a film that just barely missed my top 20 of 2014. But it's a really good found footage film. So yeah, if you like found footage, Chrissy, for example, definitely check it out. This is their follow-up. The Windmill. It stars only one person that I know, and that is Noah Taylor. Noah Taylor is an Anglo-Australian dual citizenship actor who's done numerous roles and character roles, such as the Angelina Jolie Tomb Raider films, and he was also in the Tom Cruise film and Doug Liman film, Edge of Tomorrow. But his most notorious role, I guess, for horror fans would be probably Simon Rumley's Red, White, and Blue, where he plays a character completely out of the ordinary from anything he has done before, where he plays a sociopath ex-soldier who has maybe a hidden secret. Definitely worth checking out. It was a stellar performance by him in Red, White, and Blue. But here he is listed as the top actor in this film and probably the only actor I knew yet. I would call him more of a co-star of an ensemble cast. That's all I got for the people in front of and behind the camera. Anyone else wanted to bring anything up about this film specifically that may relate to the techno aspects?
I don't have anything.
All right,
I know nothing. I have done no research. I have been a bad, bad podcaster.
That's fine. No, I mean, that was pretty much all it was anyway. Either way, it's interesting. It's a foreign language. I mean, it's an English language film, even though it is by the Dutch folk. But Chrissy, for Frankenstein's Army, they did the same thing. They actually, even though it was Soviet or Russian troops, they use English in that film as well. So I think obviously it's more to get a wider audience for their film rather than have it subtitled, but that's just a guess. Now, Eric, you actually were the first person to know about this film and then recommended it as possible topic. And I think this is our third or fourth time that we finally got it on the agenda to do. So, Eric, how did you hear about this film and what did you think of it?
It showed up on iTunes. I'd heard people talking about it before it showed up there. I heard it talked about under its original title, The Windmill Massacre, and couldn't find it anywhere. So I had to actually do a little research to make sure it was the same movie because I didn't realize there was a separate title. But yeah, I watched this back when it hit iTunes like in October. And yeah, I liked it. So I suggested you check it out, and you did, and you liked it too, and we decided we're going to do an episode, and we've been trying to get that to happen ever since.
Yeah, you got sick a couple of times, and then one time we were recording on the first of the month, and on the first of the month, I know you get swamped at work, so we pushed it back a couple of times, and one time you actually lost your voice, so...
Yeah, November was not a good month for Eric.
Right.
Oh, there was that whole thing with the Russian love child. We won't even get into that.
Well, yeah. Russian love child, dead mom, sickness, laryngitis. It was all just a big ball of shit.
Yeah. Now, you said this came out in October, probably a good time because a lot of people...
Yeah, it was right before Halloween.
Yeah. So some folks would call this a pretty good film for Halloween. So I actually saw you post that you were watching it or that you had watched it. Just finished watching it and said it was pretty good. So I decided to rent it as well. And I heard very positive things as well, Eric, about the film from various websites and so forth. So I watched it too. And yeah, I thought it was a pretty damn good film. There's numerous issues, nitpicks, whatnot, like a lot of lower budget films or films by... newer filmmakers. Yeah,
and to be honest, this crew here, we watch so many goddamn movies, I don't think it's possible for us to watch a movie without nitpicking it.
Yeah, that's true. And again, we don't just review the film, but we also critique because we really go in depth. So obviously you're going to have your nitpicks. But yeah, I liked it a lot. It's a pretty solid film for 2016. It was a good film to watch during a Halloween. It's an interesting film because it's kind of like a slasher, but it's also kind of like a monster movie. It's not.
I would feel very comfortable calling it a slasher.
Yeah, that's fair. And then a couple other things that are interesting about it too is that it's not necessarily an original idea, but they take this non-original idea and they put it in an original setting, which is a windmill area. So I thought that was kind of neat as well. Chrissy, what about yourself?
Well, I first heard of this movie. I want to say that I actually saw a trailer for it. I don't know where it would have been. It might have been on one of my DVDs or something that I had, or even possibly in the movies. But I remember saying to my cousin, it must have been on a DVD, because I remember saying to my cousin, oh my God, that looks really cool. We need to check that out. And then I forgot about it until you mentioned it to me 2 weeks ago. And I went, oh yeah, that was that one I really wanted to see and I'd forgotten about. Overall, I really enjoyed this film. I'll save all of my comments for later, but I thought this had a very Jeepers Creepers feel to it, which I liked. I think I thought that the characters were a little bit more than victims, which was nice. And in all honesty, this was the fastest movie I've ever watched. I thought this movie just flew by. I was having so much fun that I could not believe when, like, I only had 10 minutes left.
I will agree the pacing of this movie was tremendous.
Yeah, it was awesome. It was really tight and it just kept you engaged and it moved. And yet there was a lot of information communicated in a very small space, which I'm sure we'll talk about. And I love this film, and my biggest disappointment right now is that it is only available on digital. So I am actually thinking of buying it so that I can download it and burn it to my own disc so I can add it to my DVD collection, because there doesn't appear to be a DVD or a Blu-ray out, and that's a little disappointing to me. I'd really like to own this. I really liked it.
I would think eventually it'll probably come on disc. Some oddly don't, but this one probably will. It's probably what they're doing is just trying to get the VOD money right now. I know, Eric, you rented it and then purchased it just as I did,
yeah.
At least VOD-wise. And but yeah, right now it's not on disc. It's only on VOD and so forth. But yeah, Chris, if you like this film, then you should definitely check out their first film, Frankenstein's Army. Mike, what about yourself?
Yeah, I first heard of it, I think, from Eric and from you. And, you know, it's sort of like, well, it's a Dutch film called The Windmill. And I'm expecting some ponderous, artsy treatise on the existential meaning of existence. And where the windmill goes round and round, much as your life is a never-ending cycle of torment or some horseshit like that. No, I think they should have stuck with the original title, The Windmill Massacre, because that gives a much better sense of what this film is like.
Oh, I totally disagree, but we can discuss that later.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, I do disagree, but that's all right. We'll talk about it.
Well, I'm just saying, I understand that maybe the word massacre may turn off certain people, losers or something, but... You know, it's that you're aiming this for a horror audience. The word massacre is probably a good thing to include in your damn title. Just saying, because I can't imagine this having a big audience outside of horror fans. It's a fun film. It really is. You're right. It moves. I think the actors and the characters are pretty decent, even if they're all scumbags of their own some sort or another. But they're likable scumbags to some degree. I'm sure Phil will disagree about that.
No, I mean...
There was one dude I just wanted dead, but other than that...
The only one that I really hated, and I didn't hate her until we found out what she did, was the French chick. What she did was terrible, but we'll discuss. But anyway, continue, Mike.
You and your little dogs. Yeah, so I would recommend it. I'm pretty sure I just rented it. I don't know if I'll end up buying it at some point. I'm sure it'll be on DVD soon. or Blu-ray or some physical medium. And from what I know, I've not watched Frankenstein's Army. I have it. I got it like $5 in one of Scream Factory's sales in the last year. So it was a really cheap one, and someone had recommended it to me because they said the basically just said the behind-the-scenes stuff they do, the making-of stuff, was really, really phenomenal.
It is, yeah.
So if this is the same people, you know, I don't know if it'll have the same distributor because all that really matters, but maybe there's a good chance it'll have a decent package, and if it's certainly if it's cheap, I'll pick it up.
And you said it was Scream Factory was the Frankenstein's Army one?
I'm pretty sure that was by Scream Factory.
Oh, yeah. Now, Eric, have you seen Frankenstein's Army?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. What did you think of that one?
I didn't like it as much as this one.
Yep, that's fair. All right. Yeah, I mean, it's a different type of film. It's hard to imagine that the filmmakers of Frankenstein and Army are the same ones that did this, because they're completely different films in so many ways, never mind found footage versus slasher monster film. Now, a couple of things about the Netherlands. Netherlands is an interesting country. A lot of people call it Holland, and they actually do many times in this film as well, which is actually a misnomer. And what it is Holland is really two sections of a seven-section nation, or seven states or seven provinces, and two of them are Holland. The other five are are different names, and altogether they're called the Netherlands. The country has the three of the most important cities in Europe, The Hague, Amsterdam, and Rotterdam. They were neutral in World War I and were invaded by the Germans in World War II, and therefore after that decided to give up their neutrality and became a NATO member. They are one of two countries in Europe that were great adventurers and discovered many things in the world that were small. Portugal would be the other of the two small countries in Europe that did that. And their country is a constitutional monarchy where, oddly, the capital is Amsterdam, but the whole government and the ambassadorships and all that are actually in the city of The Hague. And that's
If you're anybody but Philip, you don't care about anybody but that, and you know what they mean when they say Holland.
And they do speak Dutch, and they're known for tulips, Gouda cheese, and what's that?
They make chocolate too, don't they?
They do.
Well, look, I think it's very obvious. It's unfortunate that while this was a Dutch film, that there was clearly they didn't have anybody in the film that was actually Dutch.
Actually, I think the bus driver.
No, look, nobody had wooden shoes.
Wasn't this a British film? One of the reviews I read said this was actually a British film.
It could have been funded by the Brits, but the filmmakers, or at least the director, he's Dutch.
Well, all I'm saying is when I tune into a Dutch film, I want wooden shoes. Nobody was wearing wooden shoes. They're therefore not Dutch.
Well, and I will say this about Holland. The movie's tagline
technically, the Netherlands, technically.
But that's – no, but wait, let me finish. I'm sorry, but the really cool tagline of this is Holland, this isn't hell, this is Holland would sound like shit if it was this isn't hell, this is the Netherlands.
Yeah.
Right? So,
But as with all standing dark discussions policy, we know in the end they are, in fact, all Swedes. So.
Swedes, yes.
Yes, yeah. They're Swedes.
That's correct.
Especially the Asian guy.
Yeah, exactly. The best thing was they interviewed Anthony Hopkins the other day about Westworld and asked him what his favorite scene was. And he goes, oh, my favorite scene was when I did the dinner or the lunch.
The veranda, yeah.
Yeah, with Teresa. And the actress is actually from Belgium. And even he doesn't even know where the people are that he works with, because she's actually Danish. But
when yes. Anthony Hopkins says that you're from the Netherlands, you're from the fucking Netherlands.
Or Belgium in that case.
Or Belgium or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Swede. You're a Swede. Yeah. You're a Swede.
Right. Exactly. It doesn't matter. He didn't care. So anyway, so that's what we think of the film, and that's what the Netherlands is all about. And they are, yeah, they're a country.
In theory.
They're part of the Benelux countries, which includes the Netherlands, Belgium, and Luxembourg.
Thank you for tuning into tonight's geography lesson.
Yes, yes. Now,
there's going to be a quiz at the end, so I hope everybody took notes.
Yes, exactly.
Just write the answer Swedes for everything.
That works. So, where should we start? Because it's a curious film.
Well, I'm not going to read that. I was going to read the wiki, but I'm not going to do that because the one they have on I can't even say the name of the site right. IMDb is way too wordy and it's also spoilery as hell. So I'm going to give my own brief summary of the movie, which is a tour bus full of people in Holland breaks down near a windmill and bad things happen.
That's right. Yes. Yes. And as Mike said, a lot of international cast. Most of the folks that are actually everybody that is on the tour bus, obviously, are tourists. And they're all tourists from outside of Holland. We have a French woman. We have an Australian woman. We have an English soldier. We have an English father and son. We have a Japanese guy. I may be missing one or two. We got another English doctor. I think he's English. He could be Australian, but who knows. And I think that's it. I think that's the whole cast. We actually meet the Australian girl first. And we discover that she is a nanny or au pair or a governess and private teacher for some wealthy Dutch kids. And I think she's an English teacher for them, and she gets confronted by their father stating that he found her passport, which is completely different than the name and location or nation that she was originally from. And he's going to report her to the cops, and she flees. And that's pretty much how the movie starts, right, Eric?
Yep.
Yeah, so...
Well, she smashes him over the head with a vase, which I was, like, not expecting at all.
Yeah, yeah.
Which kind of made you feel like, okay, there was a really intense reason why she was hiding her identity. She didn't just, like, commit, like, a theft or something. Like, she obviously did something really terrible. So I thought that was kind of one of the ways that this movie excelled for me, is that they managed to give a lot of layers of backstory with very, very few details. I mean, they didn't take a lot of time doing it. They told you things with just the perfectly chosen details that communicated those things so that you kind of filled in your own blanks, you know, about what this character was like. And that was one of those moments where I was like, oh, she's running from something terrible. So I thought that was a nice setup that it took 2 seconds to kind of communicate that.
Right, right. Yeah. And then we meet a group of English soldiers on leave in the red light district of Amsterdam. So this obviously takes place, or at least starts in the city of Amsterdam. And they get this guy, one of the five of them, to basically get the business dealings of a night walker or whatever you call them, prostitutes, escorts, whatever. And the brothel. He hooks up with a chick at the brothel, basically. And then we go back to the guys on the street, you know, still laughing and drinking, whatever. And then he runs out of the brothel acting strange, and he runs away. And that's pretty much that. And then we meet a father and son who are on a boat tour through the city of Amsterdam, and the son's pointing out things, and the father is more intent with taking phone calls from work, so the father-son bonding time isn't working as well as the son had hoped.
The father's the one I wanted dead from the get-go.
Yeah, I figured that was the guy you were talking about, Eric. Then we meet this French chick who is sent off to do a fluff story. She used to be a model, an actress, is now a news reporter, and she's off to the Netherlands to do a story on I think windmills or something.
Well, actually, Phil, I think she was asking that smarmy guy. She wanted to sell her photograph, or she wanted to sell photos or something to him.
Yeah.
Like, okay. She was a photographer, and he said, well, we're going to do this this touristy calendar of you know, windmills or whatever. And if you do well with this, then we'll give you something else. I think that was the deal.
Okay.
I think that's why, because she had to actually go to the place where there was windmills so she could photograph them.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. And then the Japanese guy, I don't think – do we even meet him, or do we meet him on the bus? And same with the
we
doctor.
We meet him on the bus.
Yeah. Same with the doctor too, because I don't remember seeing him prior to the bus either.
Oh, no, we saw them both.
Oh, we did?
We saw the doctor in an art museum, and he runs in a corner and sniffs cocaine or something. And
yes,
then
right.
We see the Japanese guy, Takashi, I think his name is. We see him – I don't know. He was putting like – maybe ashes or something at the base of a tree, which we find out later might have been his grandmother's ashes. But the reason you guys are not remembering it is because it was super short. Like, it was not very long scenes at all. You only got like a couple minutes with these people, not even. So.
Okay, right. Okay, that's a good point. And yeah, so obviously the Netherlands has some significance for the Japanese guy if he brought ashes to of his grandmother to the country for some reason. And yeah, that's pretty much it. Now, Eric, explain the bus setup, because the whole thing is interesting. And then you get a flashback at the end, because there's always one more person for hell or something like that. That line, that was kind of funny. You know,
so
there's
room for one more sinner.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. Yeah.
I don't know what you're asking me to describe.
Well, just that she shows up late. She doesn't have her ticket.
Oh, right,
and the bus
right.
driver says, that's okay. There's always room for one more sinner.
Yes.
Yeah, which you're thinking, well, that's just kind of nice of the guy because, you know, really the bus is going anyway. And she's like a 38-pound girl. So,
right.
You know, it's not like she's going to eat up a whole lot of gas.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And she claims she lost the ticket, and he goes, don't worry about it. I believe you. So basically she just wants to jump on the bus because she doesn't want to get caught by the cops, because this is our girl from the beginning that we were discussing. And then all the other people that we met briefly are all on the bus. So we're following a group of 7, 8, 9 characters, plus obviously now the bus driver.
And at this point, we throw up the spoiler flag.
Yep. Pretty much. That's the setup. That all takes place in less than 5 minutes. And we're on the bus within 5 to 10 minutes of the movie, right?
Yeah. Like Christy was saying, this is very smartly paced. Moves right along.
Yep. Absolutely. All right. So what do we want to discuss, Eric? Set up the.
Now I'm gonna lean on you guys tonight because I watched this 2 months ago, and I wanted to try and rewatch it before we recorded tonight, but my stupid job made me pay attention to it, so I was unable to. So I have vague recollections and little snippets.
Okay, that's fair. Chrissy, why don't you explain the beginning from the point where they get on the bus all the way to the guy in the road?
Well, I mean, basically, all of these characters, you can tell initially, although we are not given very many details about them specifically, it's not only, as we had mentioned, is this movie well-paced, it's very well-written and it's very tightly written. And much of what we learn about these individuals before they all get on this same bus, we find out through little snippets or through actions or things like that. They all get on the bus and they basically the girl who's from Australia, we're introduced to her first. She's the one who flees. She was like the wealthy nanny. She flees. And her issue, we know that she did something having to do with fire, or maybe she burned a building down, or you kind of see snippets of that. So we're sort of following her more than the others. And she gets on this bus to get away from the police. And then the old guy who drives the bus, I guess his name is Abba. It's spelled A-B-E, but they keep referring him to Abba, so that must be the pronunciation. They drive out And he's telling them he's, you know, it's like the Happy Holland tours, and Holland is like a happy place, and we're lovely people and all of this. And he takes them out through the polders. And a polder is, I looked it up, and actually that's probably not the correct pronunciation. It's when I look at the word, the phonetic way that it's supposed to be pronounced, I can't, it's like got some kind of schwa in it that.
Is that where you find a poltergeist?
It's actually spelled P-O-L-D-E-R, but the O has like a funny little, like a schwa or some kind of mark in it that indicates that maybe in their original language, it's a sound that we're not used to making or something like that. Yeah, something like that. I'm not even going to try it. But one of these, a polder, is a low-lying tract of land. I'm just going to read what I looked up. Enclosed by dikes that forms an artificial hydrological entity, meaning that it has no connection with outside water other than through manually operated devices. So it's probably has a lot to do with their tulip growing and their crops and all of that. And they go to one windmill where we get a very lovely brief history of windmills, and that there are three different kinds of windmills. And that was very interesting.
And the bus driver also talks about how most of Holland is under sea level. And yes. So what you were just describing, they've used all that system to, get the water rearranged so that they have land. And basically they said God made the earth, but the Dutch made Holland because they pretty much created land where there was none previously.
Okay, that's really cool. I didn't know that. So that's
yeah,
awesome.
And if I'm not mistaken, there's like 30 to 35% of the Netherlands is below sea level and was created by the ancestors of the Netherlands with all the dikes. And so similar to like New Orleans, except they have strong dikes, unlike the New Orleans.
Yeah, well, Eric, I've been waiting for you to, you haven't commented. That word's been said twice now. You haven't said it.
Yes. Comment.
Oh, dikes.
I'm trying to be good.
But here's what else is interesting. This Australian girl, like I said, we kind of know the most about her, and she's obviously on a medication, which we find out while they're all riding together on the bus. It's an antipsychotic. We do know that she is sort of having hallucinations. This was really interesting to me, because all of the characters on the tour were haunted by something. You kind of got that sense. But why that was interesting to me was that we were now in the land of susceptibility, in that these people were absolutely going to be open to supernatural attack. You know, the Aussie girl is hiding a dark past in which her father beat her. We know that much at the beginning. We know the young boy has a medical problem, although we don't know what yet. The Marine, we know, got into some kind of trouble the night before. But I don't know when we figure out that he killed the hooker. I can't remember if it's before the bus or if it's later. But their sins are revealed in very brief flashbacks. But like I said, the Aussie ones girl is the most. But what's also interesting is that for the first 10 or 15 minutes of this movie, I don't know about you guys, it's almost like there was a bit of a question as to whether or not this girl actually was having a psychotic episode.
Oh yeah!
Like if she really was imagining,
they definitely throw that shred of doubt out there.
And they kept it going until Takashi saw something.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because even when they arrive at the house and she's hearing things out of the radio, I'm like, I was seriously sitting there thinking, okay, did she actually kill the Marine? Like, and this is all in her head. Like, they really kept that going. They played with you for a good 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. And then, so what happens is the bus, she sees her father run into the road, or what she thinks is her father, which of course we find out later, we know the father's dead, but it's in her head, or so we think. And the guy slams on the brakes, and then they all think she's even more crazy because she's seeing that she's seeing her dad, she's seeing things. And then they can't get the bus started again, and so then they're broken down. And that's kind of where things really take a turn for the worse.
Yeah, and basically, they fight, like you said, when the bus stops and slams, she drops her pills, and the doctor sees the pills, and he's being a medical doctor. He immediately knew that these are medicines for people who have, I guess, behavioral health issues.
Psycho problems.
Yeah, so that adds to the fact that you mentioned Chrissy, which is maybe she is actually – it's an unreliable narrator, and she's actually the murderer.
I liked that a lot, and I liked that they used the guilt of all of these people for their crimes that they had committed in a very Edgar Allan Poe type of way, you know, where you're driven mad by your guilt. Guilt is one of the biggest triggers for, quote, driving a person mad, and I just really adored the way they played with that. So
yeah, so when they stop the bus because she thinks someone's in the road, and as we figure out, she thinks it's her father. So we obviously know that she's there's something wrong with her, because obviously her father would not just be in the middle of the Netherlands, in the middle of nowhere on a road, and she's from Australia. You know, it just didn't make any sense. So all the people were pissed that they stopped. There's no one in the road. She runs off the bus. The bus driver starts freaking out because, you know, you're not supposed to get off the bus. Until you get to your location. Don't ask me why, because it's not like it's a dangerous country, or in theory. When she gets back on the bus, he turns on the engine, and the thing's broken. The bus is not running, and they have no way to fix it. They have no way to get help, because the trope of horror films, you know, no one's cell phone's working. And
I love how the bus driver is almost completely uninterested in getting moving again, too.
Yeah, yeah. It's almost like...
they're like, why don't you call somebody to come visit? They're like, he's like, they don't come out here.
Yeah, right, right. And it's not like cars are going to be coming by every few minutes. So, and there's no houses, you know. So it's definitely not a good situation, but... like you said, Eric, the bus driver's fairly calm.
And everybody's yelling at him, and he's like, hey, what do you want me to do? It's broke.
And he's right there. I mean,
yeah, and when the businessman is like, oh, don't you just call, like, double A or AA or something like that, which is, you know, roadside assistance. And the guy is like, no, like you said, Eric, no, they don't
come out. They don't come out here.
Right. Yeah. So... we have a interesting reaction by the various people on the bus. Obviously, the one that Eric hates the most is the most obnoxious of all of them. You know, the typical prick, like, you dumbass, what are you doing, blah, blah, blah. And the bus driver's just working stiff, you know, what can he do? Everybody else is pretty calm, but the doctor takes initiative, and he says, what about that windmill over there? And the bus driver says, there's no windmill in this part of the country. We got to go another few miles. And he goes, yeah, but...
look.
Yeah, look. And he goes, well, it's not on the map, so I don't know what this is. And he goes, well, maybe there's help over there. And I think this is where they pretty much begin. This is... where what the Australian chick
starts with the Australian chick and the Marine guy going out together, right?
Yeah, the British Marine.
Let me ask a question. In hindsight, and I hadn't thought about it. Now, spoiler flags are flying, right? So
oh yeah, we're into spoiler territory.
Okay, so we're going to find out later on that the bus driver's in on this,
right?
So why would he pretend that there's no windmills? I mean, well, what's the deception
there?
It depends
a lot of things.
I think what it is, Mike, since, as Chrissy mentioned, that the sinners are facing their sin and ultimate punishment, I think the bus driver, being who he is allowing them to make their own choices to go and face.
Yeah, that would fit nicely in to the whole idea of in Christian morality, you know, it's always said that Jesus or God gives us a choice. We can choose to live, you know, well, or we can choose to live, you know, as a sinner, you know, or do something badly, that we have choices. We can choose between God and the devil, so to speak. I didn't think of it that way. That in particular, Mike, didn't bother me.
It didn't bother me. I didn't even think of it until just now.
Okay.
Well, Mike, it's also by him not saying these things, it keeps us, the viewers, thinking he's not part of it.
Well, I understand that, but I mean, he's not taking them on a windmill tour. I'm just saying, I don't know why he would pretend that there was no windmill or that they're in an era where there are no windmills when clearly there's a windmill.
That's a fair point.
And a windmill is trying to take them to get them murdered.
Well, okay, so that's...
Murdered or judged?
I guess that's a nitpick. I threw out my opinion, which is, well, the main thing is it probably was intentional because they didn't want... It was funny because he, you know what it is, Mike? The guy goes, there's no windmills here. And then the doctor points out there's a windmill right there. And he goes, yeah, but it's not on the map, so it doesn't count. You know, so he was playing like the dumb, you know, that type of guy.
No, so I can understand him playing dumb because obviously they're stuck. They're going to want to go to the windmill.
Right.
So I understand him not wanting to look like too excited, you know.
Right.
And so I get him playing coy. But, I mean, it's sort of like the... it's not, you know, is it a coincidence that they just stopped there? Well, no, it's not that she's hallucinating her father as part of her psychosis. It's that it's the windmill or the forces in the windmill, you know, are making them see things and manipulating them to stop there. But he probably would have stopped anyway.
True, true. Eric, your opinion on any of this? Is it a nitpick? Is it an excellent question by Mike? Do you think?
I think it's somewhere in between.
Yeah.
Now, do you think
the sort of thing I would like. I would imagine that there might be something that the filmmakers would be able to answer in a commentary track.
Yeah.
The bus driver is just trying to stay as uninvolved as possible because I think the ultimate scenario for him is for him to drive the bus out there. All the people go off and meet their maker, and he drives away again. I don't know if the whole situation of what happens with the bus later is part of his usual scenario or not. I don't think so.
Right. You mean they're a judge, not their maker, I guess.
Eric is saying that when the bus went in the water and the bus fell over and all that, that probably wasn't his usual scenario.
Right.
He probably just unloads people on the bus and that's it.
Well, and that's what he pretty much says, right? In one of his moments at near the end where he goes, I'm just supposed to bring you folks here and I'm the person that cleans up if anything goes wrong.
Right. If there's somebody that's actually innocent, then he kills them anyway.
Right. Well, also you could ask, you know, how he's a part of it and we don't know his story, so... How reluctant is he? How
the windmill too? Dun dun dun.
Or maybe windmill zero, the origin of the bus driver.
Well, we don't even know if the bus driver is human, right? I mean, he may not even be human.
Right, he could be one of those things that was the guy in Fright Night that nobody knows what he was.
Yeah, exactly. No, and that's a fair point, Mike. I mean, his backstory is really not important, except that he's the cleaner upper or the you know.
Well,
we don't. I mean, what if this is some?
Go ahead.
What if he's some poor soul who's cursed to have to help this guy out and kill those people that are innocent? I mean, we really don't know. We can come. So that might be why, and that would like explain why he doesn't really not windmill. I don't see no windmill.
Well. You know? But I don't even know if he's there to kill innocent people, Mike. I think he's there to take the folks who have repented because it doesn't matter that they repent. His goal is to still send them to hell or to the monster, even if they do repent, right? Because I think the innocent, he actually Spade at the end, isn't he? But are the one, the lone survivor.
Well, yeah, but they get the bus driver. Like, they, it's not for lack of trying.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Gotcha. Yeah, you're right. All right, so he's there just to take out anybody that the monster doesn't take out.
Right. So I guess not leave no witnesses.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, and he could have very well made some deal with the devil too. That's the part of the, that's what makes that so fascinating, is that he could actually have his own deal with the devil, in that he gets maybe eternal youth, or to, who knows, or just gets to live forever or whatever, just as long as he keeps helping this guy. But I was also wondering, Mike, in your line of questioning about what windmill and how she saw her father run out into the street and the guy had to slam on the brakes. I mean, that guy would have stopped there anyway. So I wonder if, you know, the original plan is just usually he does bring them to see this windmill, like off the bat. Like maybe they were on their way there. Do you know what I mean?
Or it might be some
planned interruption.
Yeah.
Right. Or yeah, or maybe that whenever they're sinners, we're going to be sending something out to let you know you're supposed to stop the bus. Or it may be, what if you're at a point where, and now we're just completely in speculation territory. Maybe not every bus has sinners on it.
Right.
Maybe not everyone's going to get punished. So
that's
maybe,
true.
Maybe, so maybe he doesn't always stop there.
Oh,
so maybe sometimes he's just a poor schlub, you know, like Ralph Cramden driving his bus. And then every now and then he just has some select group of heinous sinners that need to be punished.
Sinners on the bus because people suck.
Well, you know, maybe he was hoping that this was one of those days that he didn't.
Well, everybody is a sinner. I mean, even, you know, the biblical quotes from Jesus, you know, the don't throw stones if you live in a glass house because we're all sinners and on and on. But these sinners are different sinners because they have done sinned to the point of like the 10 deadly sins or the 7 deadly sins or whatever. It's the 10 commandment sins or the 7 deadly sins type sinners. They're not just you know, you stole the cupcake. You know, we're talking about really bad people.
Or Phil's primary sin, which is coveting thy neighbor's ass.
Covering thy neighbor. Does that mean?
Coveting.
Oh, coveting. Oh, okay. All right, okay, if you say so.
That's one of the Ten Commandments. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's ass.
I don't like a
phrase
like that.
Yeah, that's not for a second. And covet. I think they actually mean intimate relations and cheating, not actually.
No. The coveting, not coveting thy neighbor's ass, was referring to the donkey. Coveting the things that they possess.
Stop! What are you talking about?
Okay, let's move on. So, we don't really. I mean, they don't go into the full setup of how and why they stop this specific spot, but we do understand by the end of the movie that this is a bus of. Or a journey by a bus of a group of sinners that have done terrible things, whether it's one of the Ten Commandments or one of Saint Thomas Aquinas or whatever his name is, 7 deadly sins, and therefore they're there on. It's not coincidental they're on this bus, and they're going to stop at this specific location in the Netherlands because this unmarked or un. I mean, who knows if that windmill even exists, except only for sinners. You know, I mean, if a car is just driving by, maybe it's not even there. We don't know. These are things.
Ooh,
we'll...
that's an interesting thought.
Well, see, I thought about that, but then the boy saw it. I mean, of course, he's a boy. He probably.
But he's on the bus.
On a nightly basis.
But he's on the sinner's bus.
Yeah.
Okay, I see what you mean.
You know, so if they're just like him and his father had rented a car and they weren't on the sinner's bus or something like that. You know, then maybe they wouldn't see the windmill too. So we don't even know.
Yeah, I really loved the idea that it was just there was this nice supernatural element to this, and it was also reminded me a little bit of the forest, in that the forest kind of shows you things. It was like an evil forest as well. It wasn't just the windmill, and it wasn't just the burned guy running around. It was, I just liked that whole mystery presented. But that's what I thought, Phil. And Mike and Eric, I was convinced that people who were not on the bus probably did not even see the windmill.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking anyway myself. But either way, after a good hour or two, the bus driver finally says, "All right, if anybody wants to go, check out the windmill. Maybe there's a miller there." And sometimes these windmills actually have residential quarters as well. So there could be a family there too. So maybe they have a phone or a landline or whatever, or even a car. And so for some reason, the Australian girl wants to go and they allow her to go, which was kind of weird. But then the soldier says, "Don't worry." I think that's how it is. They let her go because the soldier agreed to go with her because they didn't want her to run off or disappear or whatever.
And wasn't the dad also being a complete dick? And at that point, they would just let her go to separate the two of them.
Well, that's true because he kept on really being a dink to her because she was hysterical. They all now know that she's on medication for mental health issues.
Problems.
Yeah, exactly. She unintentionally is the reason they're stopped. Because had she not freaked out thinking her father was in the middle of the road, the bus would have never stopped in the first place, and therefore the bus would still be driving and not a non-functioning now. So
yeah.
Yeah, and so he's pissed.
There's kind of a campaign against her.
Right, right.
Really unfair, actually.
Especially when the driver says we may have to sleep on the bus and wait until tomorrow for help. And so that pisses people off more. And I would agree with you, Eric, even though she is a psycho kook, yeah, I mean, the bus breaking down, it's not her fault, even if the reason the bus stopped was her fault. So, yeah, I'm with you on that. All right, so let's talk about the first scene where we find out this is a supernatural film. And surprisingly, a death pretty quick.
Yeah. So the girl and the Marine get off the bus and start looking around, and the military guy sees a boot, right?
No, he sees something.
Does he see one of the thigh high boots?
Oh, it could. I thought it was a lingerie or something, but yeah, it could have been. You're right. It was something that the hooker was using.
Right.
That wore. Yeah, she wore. So it kind of shocks him because it's like he had just seen this girl the night before with this boot. We'll go with the boot, Eric. That's fine.
Well, and we get a flashback, and we found out that what actually happened was that he was blindfolded and kind of led into this brothel. And then the hooker kind of snuck up on him, and he had some sort of
post-traumatic, yeah, exactly.
And snapped her neck, pretty much,
yep.
Just from reflex.
Yeah, yeah. So he murdered this innocent, and then runs away rather than reporting it. And not only runs away, but runs away from his friends, so they don't even know what the hell's going on. So yeah, he did a first, I would say second degree murder. And then makes it worse because he doesn't report it. In other words, he's trying to cover it, run away.
Right.
So he's a pretty bad guy.
So we get that in a flashback, and then immediately after the flashback, this guy gets taken down, and it takes, I don't know about you guys, it took me a second to figure out what the fuck happened.
Me too.
He's just like down on the ground. I'm like, wait, what? And it turns out that this badass guy with a really weird face and a scythe showed up and just chopped the guy's legs through at the knee. So his feet are still standing upright on the ground up to the knee, and the rest of them fell over. And so the girl screams and runs back to the bus. And meanwhile, the guy with the scythe just stomps the Marine's head into the ground, over and over and over again until it's just mush.
I did want to say, the one thing in this movie that disappointed me was the gore effects. They weren't gross. They were just bad. They were cartoony. They were really cartoony, and I could just – it was almost like – and I understand that that's part of the elan of, you know, a B-horror movie. But I think it didn't really – it was even more pronounced because the pace and the script and the story was so interesting and so good that to just kind of get that really bad, like, odd lot bin B-movie that nobody would buy kind of effect – was really disappointing. And we got it here, and we got it with the father's head getting chopped off, and we also got it with the girl at the end.
What about this scene here, Chrissy? Obviously the CGI blood was bad, very bad. But did you think that the crushing of the Marine, the, I don't even know if Britain has Marines, but the soldier anyway, the British soldier, if they had him, he had his head squashed.
That got even worse. That was even worse than the legs. That looked like literally the dude was stepping on a melon. I was like, oh my God, did they just put a melon in there and he's squishing it? Cause that is totally what it looked like.
Now, obviously, let me rephrase that. Obviously this is a low budget film. Do you think some of the issues with the effects was directly related to that? Or do you think it was just bad filmmaking?
I think they could have done it much more effectively with fewer effects. I think that honestly, if you don't have a budget necessarily where you can do high quality gore effects like that, because there wasn't much of it, I think they could have done more with cutting it away so that it didn't have this big cheese factor.
Yeah, but then fans complain that it's a PG-13 horror movie and that it's not real horror because they pushed out.
Well, I mean, in my mind, anybody that needs to watch that much fucking gore all the time is really kind of immature anyway. I mean, that's whatever. So, you know, I just think that a bad effect is less effective, especially in a movie that's this good. Like, I would expect that sort of stuff from, you know, I don't know, the gore in Friday the 13th was better than this.
Well, the gore in Friday the 13th was usually really good. That was its selling point, and for some people, for a couple of films, but that's for some people what horror is. And it's unfortunate that that's what some people focus on. But I enjoy good gore effects. I mean, you look at The Thing as a good example. Yeah. But I'm kind of inured at this point to bad horror effects, because, you know, so I'm doing quick and cheap, and it's the only way to do it, and it doesn't take me out maybe as much as it does you. I'm also just as fine with them, you know, cutting away, because I don't have an issue with them necessarily having a PG-13 horror. But as long as if there's going to be one area where they're going to skimp, if it happens to be in that area, it's not going to kill me, as long as the rest of it is solid. Well, I would much rather have a good story than bad effects than vice versa.
Yeah, no, and that's exactly what I was saying, and I think that's why it was disappointing, because the story was so good, and I was really into it, and I was really loving it, and then, oh, look, it's like, you know, red jelly being fountained out of an air hose out of a pair of obviously fake legs. I was just like, this is really disappointing.
Yeah.
But that goes back, Mike, to the title, where you said you liked Massacre in the title. And I thought that Massacre, if you kept Massacre in there, it kind of didn't live up to that. I mean, it was really three kills. It wasn't very gory.
Really? Was that it?
Yeah. We only saw saw the girl get drowned, right? She drowned. Yeah. But as far as, like, the cheese, like, there was the guy with the head rolling off. The stabbings were fine, but I didn't think those were excessively gory. Those were about right.
Well, the guy had his innards spill out.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was kind of a cheesy effect. Actually, that was the least cheesy of all of them, I thought. But I don't know what you guys think.
No, I just think that for me, a massacre is not so much about how gory and bloody it is. It's the body count. And Right. There was a significant body count. I think you got 6-7 people died. I'm willing to count that as a massacre.
But also, I thought the word massacre implied that there was a crazed killer on the loose killing people, and there is so much more to the story than that. I just think that the word massacre was not – and honestly, like, this is really – the windmill is really a much more effective title because of the symbolism of the windmill and because of what it means in Don Quixote and all of this stuff. I mean, the windmill is a very layered symbol. It's got a lot going on with it.
Well, so, it's still in the title. I didn't want to call it the massacre. It's still there.
I know, but I just don't think massacre is what this movie's really about. I think people are – if they saw the windmill massacre, they're going to expect a super gore fest, and that's not what this is.
All right.
I mean, I see Mike's point, though. All right, let's say it's not windmill massacre. They could have changed it to windmill horror or windmill something.
Because when you say the windmill, the tone of the film is – not what the windmill leads me to think, even though it does have depth to it.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, when I saw the poster, it's very, very scary in a sense. I mean, it's pretty intense looking poster of a windmill that looks nefarious. So the title windmill with that poster looks pretty good. But you're right. If you just went to your father, Mike, and said, "Hey, did you ever see the? Would you want to see this movie, The Windmill?" I would immediately think of art house, foreign language film, you know, downtown Manhattan. And I think that's what you're trying to imply, Mike, that the name...
Right, is that if this is a film... I think this is a film that's made at and targeted at a horror audience. And The Windmill isn't going to grab people. That's my point. While I understand the symbolism and is appropriate and all the rest, that's actually why I think it kind of undermines the marketing of it. Because when people start talking about symbolism in films, they're not expecting an also fun horror romp, which I think this is to some degree.
Now, Eric, what's your opinion of the gore and special effects for the – do you think the movie was a gore movie or not a gore movie necessarily like you know, a zombie eating crap, but just a slasher gore? And also – your opinion of the title Windmill, do you think it was appropriate? And your opinion compared to the original title. I know that's a lot of stuff, but...
The title, I hadn't even stopped to think about it. Don't really care. As far as the gore goes, I understand what Christy's saying, but I don't have a problem with it, because really, I mean, the type of kills we're talking about here are pretty unrealistic to begin with, so that the fact that the gore effect is unrealistic doesn't really bother me all that much. I mean, who the fuck is actually going to be able to cut through somebody's legs with a scythe?
A monster.
Right. Not real.
Can I suggest with the this is the sort of thing we needed Mythbusters for?
That's awesome, Mike.
Today we're going to try to cut through Adam's legs with the scythe. Well, we were able to get through one leg, but didn't quite make it through the second.
I don't know. Okay. I mean, if they can chop off heads and arms with a scythe, can't you chop off legs?
Yeah, but he was a supernatural being, so he's, awesome.
My point being is that the whole thing is cheesy, so I don't care if the effects are also cheesy.
Okay.
Fair enough.
Well, and obviously the kills... a lot of these type of films, whether there is more nuance to them, as you say, Chrissy, the film was still trying to get a horror crowd, so they wanted to have over the top, crazy looking kills, whether they're cheesy or not, because of its attempt to, I guess, grab the same type of crowd that would want to see the kills that you saw in, say, Friday the 13th or a film like that. I mean,
right, and it cracks me up too that Halloween is a slasher film, but remember, not one drop of blood was really shown in that film.
True. Same with
not
this,
one.
Same too.
And really, there's not much on-screen violence on the Texas Chainsaw Massacre either.
No, there isn't.
Tell that to Pam.
Point being that. There a lot of low-budget horror movies get made. And one of the reasons a lot of low-budget horror movies get made is because you can do this stuff relatively on the cheap. So I would rather have the people out there trying to make the horror movies with the cheesy effects than to not make the movie.
Sure, sure. And based off of this film where they want the monster stuff and they want the fans that like Friday the 13th and forward going, because again, the, you know, interesting kills that are unique and original with interesting weapons. They were going that way. I mean, that was the, I think, the main intent of the film. And then they built the nuance around it by using the symbolism of the windmill, I think. And I guess what you're saying, Chrissy, is you just wish that they either had a higher standard on the gore, I guess, or make it more realistic looking, I guess, rather than the 80s slasher look.
Yeah, I think that's what I was getting at. And, you know, what I said about people just wanting excessive gore, I don't have a problem with that. But what I do have a problem with is when you have just gore after gore after gore after gore and there's no story.
Right, right.
So that kind of keys into what Mike was saying. And I think that if this one had just had the gore as tastefully done, like, for example, Mike was saying PG-13, but remember, everybody thinks about Halloween as being terrifying and gory, but there's not one drop of blood in it. I think if they had gone that route, they still could have pulled it off as the, quote, windmill massacre, and I don't think you would have had all the people complaining about PG-13.
Well, I think people are just – I'm with you on Halloween, and we can talk about other PG horror films like Poltergeist and Jaws. I think people tend to be full of shit when they complain about films simply because of the rating. But
yeah,
that's,
I would agree.
That's
me. I agree with you.
But that's me. And I wouldn't have a problem with it. But yeah, so it's. I think this is clearly an homage to the 80s style supernatural slasher, you know, and.
Yeah, like a Freddy.
Right. But I think, like, for example, just as, like Scream was an homage to some of the earlier slasher films where there were more the murder mystery.
Right.
And I think really Scream ended up being a better film than most of the films it was homaging.
Right.
I think in this case, this is an homage to a lot of cheap crap that came out in the 80s, some of which was good, but a lot of it was cheap crap. I think this is probably better than a lot of it. Let's do a Friday the 13th with an actual story and actors that maybe could actually act. And, you know, if we're going to have people die because they deserve to be punished, then let's make it for things that are beyond just smoking some dope.
Yeah, no, that's a fair point. This film, that's what it is. It has this extra story, which is sinners being led to their doom or their judgment, rather than just a random serial killer that kills people because they smoke dope and have sex. What did you guys think about this aspect? And this is the one aspect that always bothers me in horror films or any genre film for that matter. Even a great film like the Russian film Solaris, you could actually argue has this aspect too. But when a person is somewhere where they know what they're seeing can't be real, and obviously I'm not talking about the Australian chick because she's, as you said, Eric, crazy nuts. But like, for example, when the doctor hears a voice in the or the French chick hears a voice, or the Japanese guy sees a little dog, and he goes, hey, the thing is that you figure they know that's not the dog that's back in Japan. They know the voice that they hear is not the voice back in France, and they know the voice they hear is not back in England. So yet they still follow it into the woods as if they're like they believe it's there. And that always irks me because we know, like in for example, The Exorcist, Damien screams, "You're not my mother," because he knows it's not his mother. But a lot of the films, they fall for it. And this one, they kind of do.
Well, did you ever have somebody play "I Got Your Nose, Phil"?
Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah.
Right. And you know, they don't have your nose, right?
Yeah, of course, yeah.
But don't you still kind of feel the need to check? I mean, just...
Yeah, I see your point. I don't know if it's a good analogy, but go on.
But I'm just saying, I think that you know, maybe they are like, you know, he sees the dog, and it's a dog. He probably maybe doesn't think it's actually the dog from Japan or wherever it was from, but it's a dog, and he wants to follow the dog, see where the dog came from. You hear a voice. It sounds like your mother or whatever, and probably not your mother, but what the fuck is it? Curiosity kills the horror stars.
Well, that was the moment when I knew for sure that the whole thing was not in the girl's head. Because even when the dude got killed with the scythe, even when the Marine got killed with the scythe and she watched it, half of me was thinking, yeah, but she's seeing stuff and we know she's on a psychotic drug that she's now out of. Maybe she killed him, you know? So until Takashi sees the dog, which I think it might, did he know the dog? Was it like a pet of his maybe or
yeah,
something?
Yeah, it was either his dog or his grandmother's dog.
Okay, yeah, because he was calling it by name and I was like, oh, he must know the dog. And that was just kind of a nice transition between, is this going to be a cray cray movie or is there something supernatural going on?
Well, I also think that, again, when you're not there and in the and you know, none of us have actually been in the position of being tormented by a demonic windmill.
Speak for yourself.
Yeah, dude.
Yeah, I know. 2016's been a rough year. but what would you do in that moment when you're being confronted with it, as opposed to you know sitting back in the luxury of your home? Or in the theater, you know, who knows where our brain would really go. And I have no idea. I've never been confronted with that. You certainly have enough people who believe in psychic experiences and ghost experiences and so forth. And if they can do that in the real world, why wouldn't somebody in the fictional world where there really are ghosts and spirits, that are out there killing people, why wouldn't they necessarily be more open to that possibility?
Yeah, I guess. Either way, it's always bothered me for whatever reason. Because I mean, if I saw the little dog, I'm in friggin' the Netherlands, and I saw a little dog that looks like my little dog, I know it's not my little dog. If I see my mother, it looks like my mother. I know it's not my mother because she's passed away. So it's like I don't know. But again, Chrissy had a good point, which is there's a supernatural thing going on. And even when the doctor walks off into the forest, he was talking to someone, I think the girl, the Australian girl, saying, all right, I'm beginning to believe that you're not crazy. You know, you may have some issues, but I know that you're not lying, I guess. And then suddenly stops and he starts walking away because he hears something. Again, that may be because once you hear or the monster chooses you, everything disappears and it's almost like you're being what's that thing when they take the hypnotized.
Right. Or like a siren luring men to their doom.
Exactly.
But wouldn't you want to sticking with you for a moment, you may know it's not your dog or your mom or grandma's dog or whatever, or especially if it's your, let's actually go with your mom. Wouldn't you still want to, you would go, yeah, I know there's an image there. It looks like my mom, but I know it's not my mom. I'm just going to ignore it. I mean, there.
All right. Let me add something to that nuance, Mike, which is simply, we already know, or at least we're told by the Australian chick, that the British military guy is dead and was murdered. So obviously, and he's disappeared. So we don't, whether he was murdered or not, he's gone and someone's claiming that he is murdered. I would start thinking, all right, there's something fishy going on here. I'm not going away off into the woods alone. And again, these may be nitpicks, but sir, I mean, even if you have a good point, if I saw an image of my mother in the distance, it's like, what the fuck? But then...
Well, and also keep in mind, this is supernatural. And like Mike was referencing the siren, the sirens actually had like a magical ability and men could not resist. they had to answer the call, and maybe it's along those lines.
Right, right. And it comes back to the, at the very beginning of this movie, there's a line by someone named Martin Berber. I didn't bother looking up who Martin Berber was, but the line says, "All journeys have secret destinations of which the traveler is unaware." And that kind of alludes to the supernatural that comes. And yeah, when this being calls you to penance or to pay, I guess maybe, yeah, it is like a hypnotize or a siren call for that matter. And you have to go into the woods and see what it is and whatnot. So I guess it's not as bad as I think. I mean, some films do it where it just takes me out of the film. This one, it really didn't, even though I did notice it. So,
but it also may be that it's just you and other people respond differently. And I think we could go pick up, a newspaper if we could find one and go in there and find five or six stories about people who did shit that makes no sense, that no reasonable human being would ever do in that same exact circumstance.
No, that's true. That's true. That's what Ascansity.com talks about all the time, right, Eric?
Sure, amongst others.
Yeah, you pick a bunch of weird stories and discuss them on your podcast there.
Yep.
And some of them are, like Mike said, five stories out of the randomly out of newspapers. Like, what the hell?
And if it's in Florida, the odds are it's going to be like 10 stories.
Yeah, that's probably true, Mike.
Woman puts alligator in baby's crib.
Why does anybody live in Florida? I don't get it. Anyway.
The weather.
Because Florida is awesome, and it's warm, and it's never gray.
Florida's fucking stupid. It's humid. It's way too hot. There's Burmese pythons. There's alligators. And it's all going to be underwater in 5 years.
And giant six-foot talking rats.
Well, I can't wait to go.
Anyway, all right, let's get back. So, I guess, yeah, so they tie up the girl. Well, they go back to the bus, right? And then the bus actually falls into the water because this is like the stream that follows. It's almost like a canal, I guess, that follows the road. And it falls over because, like, these birds hit the window. And they all have to bail out of the bus, and so they decide to take shelter in the windmill, even though the girl said the Marine was killed by some psycho.
Well, and there's an incident when they're getting out of the bus too, because it's urgent. They got to get the fuck out of the bus before it falls into the water. And on the way out, the girl shoves the kid, and he scrapes his hand. It turns out he's a hemophiliac, and so the dad goes fucking ballistic on her. But like, how is she supposed to know that?
Yeah, if anything, she saved him, but she also doomed him, is what the guy says, right? But yeah, I don't know, Eric. I mean, he was a prick, but I guess being a father and quote unquote loving your son, I guess, because it appears that he does, even if he's a distant father. Maybe he just acted irrationally and he isn't really, I mean, in other words, can you forgive him for flipping out because, oh my God, you just cut my son, even though she saved him?
The way in which he flipped out. Yeah. He's a dick.
All right. And plus they had already established the fact that he was a dick anyway. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the biggest problem is that if he had, admittedly, we've been with him for like 40 minutes at this point. If he had a 40-minute history of being a cool, upstanding guy who was passing out Jolly Ranchers to everybody on the bus, then we might be more willing to forgive a moment of dickishness.
Right.
But, no, he was just a dick.
Yeah, that makes sense. All right, that's fair. So that's the major plot point that happens when the bus sinks. Because she saves the boy, but she causes him to cut. And since he's a hemophiliac and they're not getting to the hospital anytime soon, the father begins to panic. And yet, fortunately, the doctor, the medical doctor, says, yes, eventually we'll have to panic. But at this point, based off the wound, whether he's just bullshitting the father, or, you know, to just calm him down, or if he's actually saying the truth, he's making it appear that eventually it'll be an issue, but right now it's not something to flip out about. But either way, they make it to the windmill, and they tie up the girl because they don't trust her anymore, right?
Yeah, right. Pretty much. They think she's the crazy one. Because, you know, she's the crazy one.
Right. So what goes on from here? Like, I'm a little less familiar with the film because, like Eric, I haven't seen it this week. Who goes next? And when do we actually find out the monster is a monster and someone that's supernatural to the point where he's passing judgment or
well, I think next doesn't the Asian guy have his scene, but he doesn't die because they show him what they show him, and everybody's being shown what they're shown, and they're like, it wasn't my fault. But they show the was he Japanese?
Yeah, he's Japanese.
They show the Japanese guy something about his grandmother. And he falls to his knees and honestly repents and asks for forgiveness. So the Miller is like, well, he's actually sorry, so I can't kill him.
Right. So the monster is the Miller of the mill. And basically the Japanese guy, unlike many of the other folks, or probably actually all the other folks, doesn't actually says, yes, it was my fault and I did this, and it was basically something to do where he his grandmother was dying and he didn't either visit her or something, and so she croaked and he could have saved her had he been responsible, but he was irresponsible being a stupid, you know, 20 something millennial that he screwed up. She dies. And then he, at this point, when he's about to be judged or probably killed, he actually admits, yeah, it was my fault. And so the Miller spares him.
Right. I'm looking at my notes here, and it says Little Dog and Miller Hendrick. So that Little Dog is for the Japanese guy. And so Miller Hendrick, right after that, we must have gotten the story about the Miller.
Yeah, yeah. Who wants to talk about the story? Chrissy, do you want to, or Mike, do you want to talk about the story? What it is the urban, even though it's not urban, it's a rural legend about the demon Miller that the bus driver talks about.
Right. He makes a deal with the devil basically to keep his windmill spinning or grinding at all times. And the cost of that is that he has to provide souls to the devil. He has to kill people. Basically is the short of it, right? I'm not sure if there's anything specific I'm leaving out that's important.
That's pretty much the gist anyway. And for whatever reason, the bus driver, maybe just to pass time, he tells this story. And so that's a backstory. And we kind of guessed that, okay, this Miller that we've been seeing that killed the British soldier and possibly killed the Japanese guy, because at this point we're not really sure that, because the Japanese guy just disappears from the film for a bit, is this Miller that sold his soul to the devil, basically.
Right. Well, I think that's in horror movies, nobody just tells a random urban legend unless it's specifically relating to the killer in the film.
Right. And, of course, no one believes it. And even the bus driver kind of says, oh, it's just a wise tale, obviously, you know, whatever.
Well, nobody believes it yet.
Right, exactly. So what happens next? Do you want to just go one by one through the sinners instead of going through the plot itself?
Sure.
All right, let's talk about the doctor, I guess, first. What do you think?
Well, I don't remember the details of what his sin was.
I think he was drinking or something. That was it.
I think he was high on coke.
Operation.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah, and he was doing it during an operation. And so he's out there talking to the Australian girl. What was her character's name? I had trouble keeping track of the character names.
I just put it down. Was it Karen? No, that's the wrong movie.
Jenny, maybe? Maybe it was something like Jenny. But anyway, he's out there talking to her, and he hears this beeping off in the woods.
Yeah,
and
Jennifer.
Of course it's a heart monitor, of course. And so the corpse of, I guess, this girl that he screwed up and killed is sitting there in the field. And I really liked – I don't know about you guys, but I loved all of the way these scenarios, these illusions were presented to them. They were really disturbing. Like, oh, yeah. There was just something – because, like, you see, like, the hospital table in the middle of the woods.
Yeah.
It was just really kind of unsettling. It was so cool.
Yeah, very, very, very – I guess what's the term? Unsettling is perfect, Chrissy.
Surreal. It was almost surreal. Yeah, there was something surreal about it. And then, of course, he confronts – the dead woman, and he just keeps saying, it's not my fault, it's not my fault, which means that he is not, his soul is not ready to truly repent and be full of remorse, because that's the only way you escape.
Yeah, he's just rationalizing it. I'm not the only one. A lot of guys do this while they're drunk.
Yep.
And, you know, and he's completely rationalizing away his own bad behavior.
Yes. And like, right. You know, you have no idea what kind of pressure I'm under all the time, and just making excuses for himself and et cetera, et cetera.
So. Right. So he basically, what happened was he must have, I guess that would be second degree murder, because he was coked up, did a surgery, and he fucked up the surgery. The girl dies, and somehow he covered it up, and made it look as if she just died on the operating table, even though we know and he knows that he fucked up and it was his fault because he was
on coke. Blame it on the anesthesiologist.
Well, something. Who knows what he did? We don't really find out the backstory. But either way, this is similar to, like you said, Chrissy, the Edgar Allan Poe, where guilt begins to haunt this guy. It probably has been haunting him since it happened. And now he's about to pay, and rather than looking at the ghostly image of the girl and saying, I'm sorry, I should have not operated, I was drugged up, et cetera, he, as you said, Mike, said, other people have done this, it's not my fault, you know, whatever, whatever. And as a result, he basically gets disemboweled by the miller, and he dies.
Yep.
Let's talk about the French chick, because this is the chick, or the character, I should say, that I had no idea why she was there, and she hides it pretty well until the very end, and literally turns 180, and you find out she's really evil, really evil.
Did anybody catch what she did to her competition, the girl? Did she kill her?
Somehow I
missed that.
She cut her face, right?
Yeah. So she cut. What she did was this other girl was a model just like she, and this other girl got the better jobs, and so she was jealous. So she hired a hitman to cut the girl's face, and when the girl has her face cut, she now has this huge scar. She's disfigured her. And I wouldn't even call it vanity or pride. I would call it simply she now had lost her earnings because she can't get a job as model anymore. So everything for her is gone. And so she suicides and she dies. And now this girl, the French chick, is able to get all the modeling jobs. And so what happens is when the miller comes – and actually it's even before that, she tells the story to the boy, I think, because they're talking about how we've all done bad things, and she explains this story to the boy, and then she says, I'm glad she killed herself, and good that she died, and she was, you know, she's pretty bad what she said. So the only reason
doesn't she say she was weak?
Yeah, all this bullshit, and it's like, you can say whatever you want, but not only did you disfigure somebody and have, you know, hire someone to disfigure somebody, but you literally now have them unemployed, you know, so the street person or who knows what, the, you know, if you lose your employment, you know, so it's like a football player, you know, breaking his leg and he can't ever play again. His job is done. And so.
Right. Well, I mean, and I don't want to stereotype, but if you're someone who is attractive and you've been modeling for a while, there's a really good chance that's the thing that you do.
Right.
Right. That's what your skill is. They probably didn't learn a vocation.
Right.
So she's not going out now. Okay. Well, now I'll put that engineering degree to use. Not right. saying that there aren't models who are also engineers, but
sure.
broadly speaking, if looking right. pretty is your career, that's what you're good at.
Right. And especially if you're a high paying one, right? I mean,
right.
you could go and become an engineer, use your fallback plan, but you're not going to be making the same money you were as a football player or as a model, right? So everything changes. And this woman here, this French chick, it tells the boy that she's glad and that she's weak and all this other, and who cares about her and all that, even though the whole thing was, you're the one that destroyed her livelihood, never mind her face. So it's like, you know, fuck you. So she gets drowned, I think, right, Chrissy?
Yes, she drowns.
Well, in a puddle.
In a puddle. But what was so interesting there too is that on a symbolic level, you know, there's the whole thing about looking in the pool of water at one's own beautiful expression. I want to say it was Narcissus that used to do that a lot.
That was it.
And there on the wall, you know, that too.
Yeah. So it was really nice that was sort of the way that she died, sort of tied into, you know, the old mythology and the whole thing about vanity and looking at one's reflection. I just, it was almost sort of very Seven to me. You know, where your punishment matches your crime.
Yeah.
Which was kind of neat. And I think there were a couple of things in this movie where they just did little fun things like that. And if you picked up on it, it was really pretty cool.
Right, right. That's actually a good point. Because, yeah, I was thinking of, I think it's Hans Christian Andersen and you know, the Snow White or whatever, where Mirror, Mirror on the Wall, who's the fairest? Oh, you're not. What? You know, but you're right. It goes all the way back to the Greek mythology and Narcissus, where the word narcissist comes from. Self-love. So the Miller comes behind her and drowns her in the pool of water.
Well, he reaches up out of the puddle, which that was the moment which I knew that was totally going to happen. Did you guys know that?
No.
Oh yeah, I saw it coming. But it was awesome.
I was like, "Oh, that hand is gonna come right up out of the pool, and it's gonna suck her down and drown her." Like, but it was still super fun. I really liked it. I think that was my favorite kill, actually.
Oh, for me, definitely, because I
it was after, my favorite.
After what I found out she did, I was like, I wanted that bitch to die.
Notice Phil is far more upset about a beautiful woman getting maimed than he is about.
No. There's a difference, right? I mean, see, the reason this one pissed me off more was because, like, she had no respect for the person she killed. In other words, she considered that person she killed or had got killed a piece of garbage, basically. While everybody else, their murders, they didn't necessarily think the person they were killing was a piece of garbage. Most of them were fuck ups. Because there was the Australian girl, which is her father was a abuser, and then her brother mistakenly was in the house. It was just something about how this woman was so evil about the person that she killed. I don't know. So it has nothing to do with
people. Well, it was like with the doctor was neglect.
Right.
Right.
Neglect and denial.
Right.
And this girl, this was malice. This was jealousy. This was pettiness and zero remorse.
They all, in a way, sort of each character and their motives for each murder reflects a different I don't want to say seven deadly sins because I'm not quite sure that that's where it goes, because this just occurred to me right now. But like you were saying, the Aussie girl killed because she was so oppressed and he was a bad man and she needed to get rid of him. In a lot of ways, she's the only one whose murder you could almost sort of justify because the father was so horrible. The father could have killed out of blind rage.
But she's guilty of her, even though it wasn't intentional, her brother dies in the fire as well.
Right, but like the father who killed the wife.
Oh, that guy.
That was probably extreme rage. Because remember the boy said, oh, I'm so, you know, how come you're so angry all the time, blah, blah, blah. So I think the father was rage, right? The Aussie killed out of rage. The Aussie killed out of, I'm sure I could find a cool thing to describe that. And then, the doctor was neglect.
Right.
Like you said, I really liked that. Takashi was, because he abandoned his dying grandmother, basically. So right. I'm not quite sure what that would fall under. Oh, I'm going to play with this now in my head while you guys are talking. But, you know, each person was motivated by, like I said, I don't want to call them the seven deadly sins, but if I really played with it, I probably could shoehorn that and make it work. Yeah.
Right. And I'm wondering if, with Jennifer, or Jessica?
Jennifer.
But Jennifer, if the issue is that, because she killed her brother, I wonder if she really is sorry she killed her brother. Not because, you know, she's happy he died or anything, but in his death, she still got rid of her abusive father. And she just may be too glad that her father is gone to feel proper remorse over the death of her brother.
No, I think part of the reason she went as far as she did is because she was also trying to protect her little brother. So I think she really is horribly.
Yeah.
But I
see what you're saying, but if I'm not mistaken, she took the brother out while he was sleeping and put him on.
She didn't. No, I'm not. She obviously didn't try to kill her brother. I'm saying is that it's clearly an accident. She sort of feels bad about it, but can she really repent? Can she really say,
right,
I wish it didn't happen, because if it didn't happen, then she also wouldn't have killed her father.
Right.
Is it the fact...
And I think the fact that she killed her father is also, I mean, yeah, he was doing horrible shit to her, but...
still first degree.
By murder? I don't know.
It's still first degree murder, yeah, because it was intentional murder.
Well, I don't think that the devil worries about what degree murder, but...
Well, it's in your heart, is that, or even though she's trying to escape an abusive person, she planned and murdered the person, and then there was unfortunate consequences, which is the brother died as well, which wasn't planned, but to first-degree murder, whether we want to use legal terms or not, the point is in her heart, she wanted the murder. So that alone would be enough, maybe, for the devil to want say, okay, she just broke one of the...
Which, by the way, totally stupid rules, because he totally fucking deserved to die.
Oh, he was a piece of shit.
I'm with you on that. I was like...
I think it's the brother is the issue, not the father.
Maybe.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. But you could argue, and I don't know how it is in Australia, but you could argue that she could have just took the brother and went to... protective services, and then the father would just get arrested or a warrant, you know, to stay away.
Sadly, things very rarely work out like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's true. My sister used to work for Department of Child and Family Services in the state of Texas, and it's a nice thought, but in all honesty, this is how bad murders like this happen when somebody freaks out because something isn't done. You know, it just doesn't happen that way. There's all this bullshit.
I would imagine something happened before.
Tape. Yeah.
No, that's fair. That's fair. So I guess you're right. I mean, her justification to kill the father, even though it was taking a life, I could see how her her being, first of all, she's mentally disturbed anyway, but second, how she could logically think this is a good thing because it will protect both myself and my brother from harm.
Well, why do you think she was mentally disturbed?
We don't know enough in the backstory, but I could see that, yeah, she's mentally disturbed because of the abuse from her father.
Right, though, so it all plays into that. I mean, I have a feeling if this was a court of law, which the devil isn't playing by, there's a really good chance that she would have gotten off for justifiable homicide, not for the brother, which was an accident. But I think she would. I think that they would make a good case of saying she wasn't competent.
Yeah, I could see her getting off for mental health issues, but I don't see her getting off for justifiable homicide for the fact that it was planned. But you were sick, Chris. You gonna say something?
Well, I was just gonna say, in terms of the story, not talking about, but in this particular movie, she actually redeems herself at the end because she says to him, she says to Kurt, the little boy, "Don't worry, I'm not gonna let him get you," which is the promise that she made to her little brother.
Yep.
Which she failed at, basically, even though it was kind of in a roundabout way, but she failed.
I don't know. She failed. He didn't get her. She got him.
Yeah, she got him. The Aussie's promise to the little boy that she's not going to let him get him is there. But then the other thing that she says is she redeems herself because remember she says, "I couldn't go back into the trailer to get him because of the fire. I was too scared." But then at the end, she rushes into the burning windmill to save the kid. Yeah. So she does actually redeem herself. The ending parallels her story in the opening. She does go in. She does save the kid.
But,
so that's why I was kind of disappointed when she actually did get whacked, because I was like, well, wait a minute. She redeemed herself. She corrected it. She conquered her fear and she actually saved him. And she didn't let the guy get him.
I think the problem was is she didn't repent for the murder of her father, even if he was a scumbag.
Okay, I could see that. Yeah, but I'm with Eric on that. I just don't think the guy. I don't think he was, you know, worth her.
Wait a minute. But I also think when you bring that up, and it's a good point. That's her, it's character growth for her. It isn't necessarily the same. It shows her overcoming a fear she had before.
Right.
It doesn't necessarily show her repentance over
something
she had done.
Right. Exactly. So she her character growth, and she saved another boy, but that is only like a roundabout 180 from her, you know, the past where she screwed up and had her brother die, but it doesn't necessarily mean that she repented. I see your point, Mike. I mean, that could explain another thing. I'm still thinking that's part of it, but also she never would repent for the killing of her father anyway. And the devil, he doesn't care because, you know, I mean, it's weird. You know, it's like war, right? I mean, you go off and you fight a war and you shoot somebody, and yet you're not a sinner in theory. But I always, when I was a little kid, I was like 10 or 8 or whatever, I always questioned that to my priest and my parents. I go, but mommy and daddy, I know we had to fight those people, but, you know, we still shot those people and they died. And it says thou shalt not kill. It doesn't say thou shalt not kill as long as you're not, you know, protecting yourself from abuses or against evil dictators who may kill everybody, you know. So it's a hard thing to quantify, I guess, in religion, in what the devil or God thinks. You know what I'm saying? I mean, I don't know. I mean, I guess we could ask a priest or some clergyman, you know, rabbi or whatever. But I don't even know if they could answer it correctly, because if they say, oh well, it's okay to in some cases because of, you know, self-defense or this or that, it's still, I mean, the Ten Commandments aren't written that way, right? I mean, and this is supposed to be, I guess this is a religious horror film for the fact that it's supposed to be the gates of hell and the demons coming to take people to hell, right? But I don't know.
That's a fair point.
But
we're coming up on 2 hours here.
Yeah, let's talk about the father. We find out that he murdered the mother, and so he gets his, and he refuses to repent, obviously. He starts flipping out saying, she was a bitch! She stole my son! She ruined my life! You know, and so
I thought that was actually the creepiest kill, though, with the phones.
Yeah, that was
I really cool. liked that. I mean, I don't know about you guys. I thought that was kind of cool, actually.
Yeah.
Where he's watching his dad get whacked on a cell phone. I just thought that was really – I was like, finally, a horror movie that's using cell phones the right way.
Sure. And then let's talk about the bus driver, because he really is the cleanup guy, right? So he – even though the Japanese guy gets spared by the Miller, I guess it doesn't matter – to this human guy, bus driver.
Here's what is unclear to me is whether the bus driver guy is killing these people because the Miller wants him to, even though he's can't because he's bound by whatever rules of the supernatural, or if the bus driver is just like a homicidal maniac that signed up for this because he wants to kill people.
I know. It makes sense, Eric, to think that, because it's like if the Miller has made his judgment and the person has repented, why wouldn't the bus driver say, okay, let him go?
Well, and how did this whole arrangement come to be in the first place?
The Windmill Zero. The bus driver story.
Once upon a dyke.
Eric wins the internet.
You just know that would end up in the wrong section of the video store.
Yeah.
I don't know, Eric. Yeah, I mean, maybe it's a combination. Maybe he's there to clean up, but he also is gleefully interested in killing, maybe because he's a sociopath himself, you know? I mean, because you're right. I mean, the Japanese guy has been spared by the gatekeeper of hell, or the demon, or whatever you want to call him, and therefore you think, okay, let him go. But no, that isn't the case. The bus driver then does the cleanup work by killing the Japanese guy, and so you figure, I don't know. I mean, and then the bus driver's there; he's going to kill the boy too because he has to clean up the mess. He goes, and he even says it. He goes, "I'm sorry that you're here because you know you're an innocent and you shouldn't even be here," but unfortunately, you're here. Therefore, I have to take care of this mess. I don't know. I don't know why the screenwriter decided to add the fact that those who have repented are still going to get killed. Except the bus driver himself was insanely evil and crazy anyway. And
yeah,
two,
I don't know.
Yeah, and
a prequel.
The only other thing would have been, and two is that the bus, yeah, actually I can't even remember anymore, but either way, yeah, I mean, this is, like you said, Mike, something that a commentary would be good.
Yep, it would be helpful.
So basically the Japanese guy wants to help Jenny burn down the windmill, so he's trying to figure out how to do that, and he's looking around trying to find gas. And then he finds gas, but there's not enough, so he comes up with this plan to siphon the gas out of the bus and use it to burn down the windmill. And the bus driver's like, step, step, step. No, you're not doing that.
Right. Yeah, so that makes actually sense, because he's protecting the windmill, too. So if the Japanese guy had just walked away, he could have walked away, maybe. So maybe.
But with the kid later, he makes it clear that he's intent on killing everybody.
Okay, yeah, that's fair. All right, so I guess let's talk about what happens. They burn. So either way, she gets the gas, and she burns down the windmill, and she thinks that will, I guess, clear this whole mess. And everybody, like, once the windmill's gone, the gatekeeper will, or hell demon, whatever he is, will go back to hell, and everybody will be safe. But that doesn't happen. And instead, the demon...
She does have a wicked hallucination.
Go on, explain.
she just, there's a, well, first of all, did you understand what the bone was that she ends up with?
No.
Anyone?
Waiting.
I don't have an answer. I'm asking.
Chrissy, what about you?
What was the question?
when she has a hallucination of her father, she ends up basically bashing him into a pulp with a bone.
Right.
Do you understand what that bone was? Was it a previous victim?
Yeah, it was the bones of the previous victim.
Okay.
Because remember he had the room upstairs and she likes to, that was where I think he was keeping the bodies, because there was that whole part of the legend where the bones of people were ground into
the
flower. Yeah. And at the end of the movie, the bus driver had the flower with him.
Okay.
So I think the bone was probably just something that was unground from a prior victim, because you get the sense that he takes these dead victims and like strings them up in that attic room and waits for them to kind of decompose so he can get the bones to add it to the flower.
As you will.
Yeah.
So she has this hallucination about her father and bashes his head into a pulp with a bone and then realizes that the whole thing was imaginary. So yeah, they burn down the windmill and the fire starts in the windmill and then the kid is still in there. So she, like we were talking about before, she actually has to go back in there to rescue the kid, which she does. And then she comes back out. And it looks like we're going to get our happy ending. But no. the Jenny and the kid are sitting there, and the miller is still up there by the burning windmill. And, oh, he's got a chain with a hook, which he throws at a high velocity. And hook goes right through Jenny's head, and he reels her into the burning windmill. That was pretty fucking awesome, I thought.
It was.
And of course, the kid gets her blood all over his face, and he's all scarred for life, which is cool, because all kids should be scarred for life.
Now, I was surprised. I thought she was going to be a survivor girl, but so when it didn't happen, I actually was kind of happy, because, as Eric always says, I like things that aren't predictable, and I didn't predict that she would die. And so it felt more original because of that. And it kind of leaves it more of a unhappy ending, even though the boy survives.
Well, and then the boy survives, but we see that the burning the windmill down did no good, and the bus driver is still out there gathering people up to come back to the windmill, which is now still the way it was before.
Right. And he actually – so, we flash forward a day where the Holland bus tour – is going to leave, and the same thing happens where this last person runs to the bus, is late, and says, oh, I don't have a ticket. And he says, oh, we always have room for one more sinner. So it appears that this is a ongoing thing where sinners are drawn to this area to be basically brought to punishment.
Right.
And that's pretty much how it ends. And so, yeah, so the bus driver doesn't die. The windmill doesn't really burn down. Do you, either, any of this cheat for you guys, or because it's supernatural and related directly to hell, it doesn't matter?
Yeah, what you said, the latter.
Okay, yeah.
I actually kind of expected that, because it's a horror movie. That sort of it's the sting at the end of Nightmare on Elm Street, right, where Nancy gets in the car and thinks everything's fine, and then Freddy's hand comes out and grabs her mom, and the roof for the convertible closes over and drives off to hell. You know, it's that sort of, you think it's safe, but nope, you're still fucked, because you're still bad, and you're still going to hell. Devil wants his due.
Yep. So, all right. So, yeah. This,
I will say one thing we haven't mentioned yet is the look of the miller.
Talk about
and
that.
And I thought he was a pretty good monster. What did you guys
think? I really liked him as a monster, to be honest with you. I'm kind of scared. I'm serious. I think I'm going to sleep with the light on tonight. I thought, damn, if they could have only done as well with the gore as they did with this guy. He's scary.
Christy?
Like, yes.
Are you near a windmill?
No, but there's like
a you're good. You're good. You're good.
All right.
You don't need the light on.
Whoever the actor is that played was perfect too, because he was like one of those barrel chested behemoths, and then they throw on the Miller outfit with the apron and all this other stuff, if I'm not mistaken, and then his face is a combination of like burnt flesh and just a deformity almost. It's kind of interesting. Yeah, he was a pretty cool killer. I gotta say.
Well, because as we all know, deformed people are evil murderers.
Right.
If life were so simple as all the bad people were ugly.
Oh, so you're telling me Disney is wrong?
Telling you Disney is wrong.
Go read some of Aesop's Fables. That was the moral of the story in a lot of them. That ugly people are evil and they're not as good as the beautiful people. That's those wacky Greeks for you.
Ugly and deformed, you're even worse.
Jeez. Yeah, oh, yeah, absolutely. They're the worst.
That's terrible. Anyway. All right, so any other things that we wanted to mention about the film that we may have missed? Anything?
I did want to mention the significance of the windmill.
Yeah, go ahead.
For it, Christy.
Well, windmills, as we know, are tied to air, obviously, because they move air in order to work, and they need wind to work. And the air in paganism represents the intellect or thought, because there's like four, you know, there's like air, water, the four elements, air, water, earth, and fire. And so air is always associated with the intellect, the mind, also creativity. And it's, I think, therefore I am, which kind of ties into the plot in a way that makes sense, because all of the people in this story are not truly presenting their real selves to the world. And they're also not being honest with themselves. So in a way, they are sort of creating their own versions of themselves, which ties in, you know, with the intellect. And do we ever always come to terms with who we are and show the world all of us? We never do. So I thought that was interesting. In dream interpretation, when windmills, they say if you dream of a windmill that there's a big transformation coming in your life, or that you are going to transform, which also kind of ties into this movie's plot, because all of these characters are transforming. They're not only going to cross over from life into death, which is the, you know, obvious answer, but they're also coming to terms with their guilt and with their mistakes, or they are choosing not to transform. So it's interesting that the windmill was the symbol over all of that. And then, of course, you have the whole Don Quixote thing, which I think is the most significant and most interesting symbol for the windmill in this. In the book, Don Quixote attacks a windmill thinking it's a giant. And there's an expression in – I believe it's an idiom – I'm not quite sure what they're called, but there's an expression and it's called tilting at windmills. Mm-hmm. Like, are you tilting at windmills again? And that means attacking imaginary enemies. And what are they doing when they're going out into the woods? They're imaginary enemies. They're guilty. You know, the things that they envision, they're being brought into the woods by imaginary illusions that only they're seeing. So I just thought that all of that was super cool and interesting. So there you go. There is my litany on the windmill.
No, and it makes sense because, I mean, everybody, if not read the story, has heard the Don Quixote fighting the windmill. And you know, never mind the fact.
I just think Quixote is a weird name for a donkey.
and then, yeah, that's true.
I got it, Eric.
And then me and Mike mentioned that, you know, windmill alone sounds like this would be an art house film anyway. So I think definitely the screenwriter was most certain. And there's three of them that wrote it: the director, this Mitchell guy, and then a woman, Suze Quid. Specifically, we're probably trying to say something about the windmill. I mean, it dominates the whole film, so never mind the title. So anyway, all right. So I guess we can give our final thoughts and then wrap up the episode. So Eric, since you chose this film, you wanted to do it, and whatnot, give us your final thoughts. Do you think it's a top 10, top 20, or do people have to wait?
I am almost positive it's top 20. Don't know about top 10. But I do recommend the movie, and if you like slashers or supernatural stories, it kind of falls into both categories, and you should check it out.
All right, very good. I would recommend it. It's a pretty solid horror film. As Eric and Chrissy said, and you did as well, Mike, it moves smoothly. It's got some cool kills. It gets characters that you like at first, and then some of them you don't like, and there's good reason for it. So when their passing happens, it's not necessarily a bad thing, like a lot of slasher films from the 80s, so it has a throwback feel as well. And also, it's a monster, and you know, like the Freddy example, I mean, it's most certainly a much different film than that, but it has a slasher feel with a monster similar to like Nightmare on Elm Street. I would recommend it, and I'm not sure where it will fall on my list, but it's a solid film for sure. Chrissy.
Well, I think I said at the beginning, I really love this film. I think it's well written. I think it's tightly paced. I really like the way that they play with you, that they use some Poe-esque elements. I love the fact that the windmill story is so inventive and so creepy, and also that the windmill is such an apt symbol for like kind of what's going on underneath with all these people. Really enjoyed this movie. Really cannot wait to own it. I think it's definitely worth the rental. It's got some fun twists in it. Definitely do it. See it. It's a couple of bucks. Take some time out from your holiday shopping or whatever it is that you're doing and just chill out. It's going to go faster than it seems. I couldn't believe it. I thought I blinked and it was over. It was just so good.
Yeah, and the whole setup too. A lot of times people get bored and they say, "Come on, let's get to the horror elements." But I think the setup move as quick as the.
Oh my gosh! Yeah, like I think 14 minutes in or 12 minutes in or something, we were on the bus. Like it, right?
Yeah, and at quarter past, and we were broken down, and we knew something was bad going to happen. Yeah,
yep. So. It was nice. Mike.
Yeah, well, again, there's always those movies that somehow we manage to unearth every year, and there's always independent horror films like Green Room or It Follows or the ghost story in upstate New York.
Eric likes What We Are.
We are still here. Yep.
That everybody finds and everybody talks about, and if you look, 90% of the horror podcasts will cover it. And sometimes it's, or, you know, because, or Starry Eyes is another good example. And sometimes because it's really good, sometimes it's just
Cheap Thrills. Cheap Thrills is another.
Cheap Thrills because Netflix pushes it. But every now and then we find something that I don't think anybody's talking about.
Landmine Goes Click is just like
Landmine Goes Click, and in this case, and I'll go with your Chocolate Strawberry Vanilla. I hate to say it from last week, but
there's
that one. But I think Eric has found a gem that I don't know any other horror podcasts, not that I listen to all of them, and God knows there's a gazillion of them, that have talked about this film. And this is a really good find. This is a buried treasure. And yeah, I'm not going to say necessarily a top 10 film, but it's got a really good shot at being somewhere in my top 20 for the year. And I don't think that's a bad thing at all. And I would say anyone who likes slasher films for reasons other than gore you know, would probably get a kick out of this, especially the later slasher films, the Freddy, the post Mrs. Voorhees, Jason Voorhees, Friday the 13th films. They'd probably get a kick out of this. I think it's a good film.
Yeah, and that's a fair point, Mike, because I think what Chrissy said is perfect, because since it has all these nuances, it makes it work for the people who like art house or story-driven horror films. Yet, as you mentioned and Eric mentioned, it has the cool kills and the awesome monster. And so it works perfectly for, you know, the on the surface level horror fans who just like, you know, the gore slasher kill films. So I think it works for any type of horror fan. It's definitely not a horror film that only a select audience would like.
Yeah, I would agree. I think maybe that – I think you just hit the nail on the head. I think it's good for both. I mean, unless you guys disagree, I think it appeals to, yeah, to everybody.
Yeah, I mean, it's Mike, you had a good point. Obviously, this film is only a film for horror fans or genre fans, but I think it encompasses almost all horror fans because it has everything for every type of horror fan, except maybe the boobs stuff. But it has everything else: the blood, the gore, the slasher, the monster. But it also has the thinking man, the people, and what the consequences they have to deal with. You know, all the art house stuff that you would see in an art house film, too. So I think it works for almost any horror fan.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
So yeah, Eric, good choice. I think we all liked it. Yeah, I was curious what Mike and Chrissy were going to think about it, because I wasn't sure if it would be there.
Mike totally duped me. He started out tonight like he hated this movie.
Well, you know, honestly, whenever when it's one of us who likes a film, it's always a little trepidation when Eric and Phil both like the movie,
yep.
You have different enough tastes that to appeal to both of you, it's got to be hopefully something decent. Hopefully.
Sure. Yeah, yeah. No, that's a fair point. Yeah, it was like that movie Final Girl. When Eric said it sucked and I said it sucked, you go, well, that pretty much is the whole stream from
our house. It really sucks.
Yeah, it must suck. And it really
this
does
must
suck.
Be shit, yes. Yeah. And again, that's the Final Girl singular, not the Final Girls plural, which was a good film.
Which yeah, was that it? Was actually a lot of fun.
That was a great film. Yeah. Yeah, the plural was great. Yeah,
the Adderall-fueled strip cheese is a memorable scene. I love that.
Yeah.
I just with the mittens. I just that's actually the one scene in that film that sticks in my head is her sitting there with the mittens, not understanding why she has to have mittens.
Yes. Anyway, back to this. Next week we have a special thing. We're going to do a holiday themed movie for the Christmas because
I think we could say what it is in case people want to check it out.
Yeah, you want to do it? All right. Yeah, I mean, it's so publicized, it's ridiculous. Chrissy doesn't know yet because she wasn't on when we discussed, me, you, and Mike were talking about it on before the Westworld podcast. But it's a brand new 2016 horror film. What's it called again, Mike?
All Through the House.
All Through the House. It's been advertised everywhere. Any blog or horror website, never mind, everywhere on Facebook if you're a fan of horror films. It's been advertised everywhere, and it's getting some buzz. Whether it's a good film or not, you'll have to judge yourself, but we'll be doing an episode on it as our Halloween-themed movie, and it's perfect.
Halloween?
My God, what a dumbass. A Christmas-themed horror film.
Christmas, you moron. Christmas.
Exactly. And it's good, too, because it's a new film. It's a 2016 film, so it actually qualifies for a potential, you know, best of or worst of or whatever. So doing that rather than going back to a classic like Gremlins or Silent Night, Deadly Night, this is something a little new, taking a... similar to Krampus, like last year, right?
Where, do not stop me from watching Silent Night, Deadly Night every Christmas.
You shouldn't. You shouldn't stop from watching. It's a great film, especially now on Blu-ray. But, all right, so I guess with all that stated, anybody go check that film out. That's some free advertisement for All Through the House. And then you come back next week and you can hear us talk about that. So, Eric, why don't you lead us out?
Hold on.
What?
Hold on. Do you also want to get into that since we're in December? When we were doing the New
Year's? Oh, yes. Yes, yes. Explain what we need listeners to do.
Oh, right.
Right. There's an episode we want to do coming up, and I kind of had this idea of a New Year's resolution episode. And no, you're not going to have a list of things to actually do, but it's something where we all have films on our list or in our pile that we've wanted to watch and have not gotten to, especially like
blind spots.
So, and especially like classic films. I'm not talking about, well, you wanted to see The Darkness when it came out earlier this year, but you didn't get a chance to get to theaters. I'm talking about stuff that you have no real good excuse for not having seen at this point in your life.
I've already chosen mine.
I saw earlier this year, Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, right? Which is a film I've been wanting to watch for a long time. It's been sitting in my DVR for 2 years.
But you are, Blanche, you are.
Ah, yes. Yeah, in that chair. So, this is your chance, and what we're gonna do, we're gonna do one episode for a New Year's resolution. All the participating hosts that week will be watching a film. We are not gonna spend 2 hours talking about each movie. We're just going to spend a couple of minutes, sort of like doing like when you're in school, you had to do like the quick oral book report. And, you know, what did you watch? Liked it, didn't like it, maybe a quick chat about it, and then we're going to move on. And we are interested in hearing from you we're challenging you, go watch a movie that, you know, maybe it's The Birds, or maybe it's Touch of Evil, or, you know, something like that. As long as it's,
That's well known, perhaps a classic that you have not seen.
Yeah, and now, unfortunately, the term classic, it might pain us a little bit, because for some of our younger viewers,
that's why I said perhaps.
Yeah, what you consider classic, and we just consider modern films, and we refuse to admit they were old enough for them to be classics. Yeah, I don't know, maybe you never saw The Thing, maybe you never saw Halloween, or what have you, or Scream. God, that film's 20 years old. 21.
Oh,
best film ever. Best film ever.
But and send us a note, either a voicemail or on Facebook, or an email to darkdiscussions@aol.com. And again, give your own little mini book report about that film.
Also, just
one is all we're looking for.
That's true. So please do that, and we'll read those out on that episode. However, we're going to be doing our end of year episode as well, and we always post on the Facebook page, but folks who aren't on Facebook or not on the Dark Discussion Podcast Facebook group won't know about it. But what we're looking for is your top 10 horror films and top 10 other genre films, fantasy, sci-fi, etc., and email them in to darkdiscussions@aol.com, and we will read them off on our year in review episode.
Although we may do so quickly if we get a bunch.
Exactly. So please send those in as well. And then last item is that one of our listeners, Gage Foltz, who actually, speaking of what you said, Mike, hadn't seen The Thing for the first time. He just saw it about 3 weeks ago. So he finally got to the bucket list and saw that film. But either way, he is in the U.S. Navy, and he goes off for about 5 or 6 months, starting at the end of December, to be on a submarine. And if anybody wants to donate your old horror Blu-rays, DVDs, or whatnot, or books, horror books, whatever, he is willing to take them so he can watch them on the very boring downtime on a submarine. A few of us have already done that. Chris Genro of Canada, myself, two or three other people.
I've got a box sitting in my car. I tried mailing it to him today, but there was an issue at the post office, and hopefully it'll be going out tomorrow. I kind of laughed because I have a bunch of DVDs. I'm trying to sell it whenever my mother-in-law has a yard sale, and so I just took a picture of every box, and I said, tell me what you want, I'll send it to you, and he picked out a few, and I had to laugh, because the first two he said were Crimson Tide and Hunt for Red October. It's like, okay.
Yeah. Of course.
Why wouldn't you? Yeah, that makes perfect sense.
Submarine doesn't react well to bullets.
So if folks want to do that, just email darkdiscussions@aol.com, and we will get you his mailing information. And also, he's been promising that he's sending a submarine memorable, or if that's a word, memorable coin from the sub that he's on, or something like
memorabilia?
That.
Memorabilia?
Memorabilia. That's there. You go. Okay. Thank you. I don't know what I'm saying. I said Halloween.
We're merchandising the Navy now.
He's going to send
merchandise
memorabilia back to you. So give some, get something back as well. So darkdiscussions@aol.com to get that information. With that stated, Eric, why don't you lead us out?
All right. Thanks for tuning in tonight to listen to us talk about the windmill. Come back next week. We'll be talking about All Through the House.